Soldier, nestled in your hollow shoulder, the unknown soldier.
People in Spain. I know a Spaniard, an older man who's a friend of mine. I mean, in fact, it's almost unusual that how many, you know, unless you're of Spanish ancestry, how many Spanish people or Spanish-connected people that I knew. So, I mean, people. I mean, just, we look at that and we're just horrified. But other than, and then when it happens in our own country, we just sort of tisk. I mean, what happens to us? I mean, that's what changed on September 11th. One of the few times that the faces of the victims of mass bombings or whatever were us, American civilians. And yet, with this attack in Spain, 200 dead, what is it up to now, 1,500 wounded, almost 2,000 casualties, and probably some more of those that are critically wounded now will die. And I just thought, I mean, how insane. I mean, who could do these? What kind of human beings? I mean, then you think about mechanized warfare, just people up in these bombers, you know, okay, all right, let's go back for, play a little video games after. It's not, you know, the carnage is the same, of course. But, and I can't remember the name of that central, I don't have that in front of me, that central train station. And one friend of ours, two friends of theirs in Spain, a married couple, they were traveling separately. One had just left the station when the bomb blew. Another would have gotten there in about 10 minutes, so they were both safe. And another woman who we know was telling us, was just crying, talking about that station and how that train station was her favorite train station in that whole country, and how Madrid is her favorite city in that country, and how Spain is her favorite country in Europe. I mean, I don't travel to Europe, so I've never been to Spain. But one thing that we know, and here's what I thought about this, and I mean, maybe we should just stick with the human suffering, with the misery. I mean, it's inconceivable. I mean, well, I guess it isn't, is it? I mean, why am I saying that? I mean, it's conceivable because it's September 11th with, 10% of the casualties, or, you know, a little less than 10%. And yet, you know, the real, I mean, to us, it was a symbol of this national tragedy, of this attack on what you know, this tranquility that we thought that we enjoyed, the safety, much in the way that December 7th, 1941 did. But the people who really suffered very directly, I mean, of course, were the people that lost loved ones, the friends of the people, the associates, just somebody down the block, thousands of people just gone. But that happens, you know, I mean, like, what was so shocking to us? We usually don't lose thousands of people, and the Spanish don't either. So suddenly the reality of all this and the possibility. I mean, I take trains once in a while, I usually fly. So planes seem pretty safe now, and now we have to worry about trains. Saying that with all this money that Bush has wasted on this illegal and unnecessary war against Iraq, and you could probably include Afghanistan in that as well, but that's a little more complicated. Certainly, the big waste and the big unnecessary and the big illegality and the big lie was in Iraq. And rather spending this money to protect us here at home, we're wasting this fortune. Paying U.S. corporations, Bush's buddies, to first destroy Iraq and then rebuild it. Well, what's happened in Spain, the opposition socialist scored a dramatic upset in Spain's general election today. They unseated the conservatives, the prime minister, Aznar, A-Z-N-A-R, was another one of Bush's toady buddies, like Tony Blair. That, I don't know, could he have believed all that guff about weapons of mass destruction? Probably not, but he went along with it for who knows what reason. 90% of the Spanish people were opposed to Spain's entrance into that war, the buddying up with Bush and Blair. 90% of the Spanish people opposed being involved in Bush's war, Bush's big lie war. And so when you think about it, if there's 200 people killed, 180 of those people were opposed to the war. So, I mean, these nutballs that are supposed to be, you know, the guardians of the Arab people or the Iraqi people, the Palestinian, they're killing people that are saying no to war. Doesn't make a bit of sense. It was the first time a government that backed the Iraq war has been voted out of office. I suspect there will be two big ones soon. Tony Blair and George W. Bush, the man responsible for it all. Rodriguez, let me see if I can, don't have enough light in here, if I can see his last name. Zapatero. Rodriguez Zapatero, who is, his whole name is José Luis Rodriguez Zapatero, the incoming prime minister, has pledged to bring home the 1,300 troops that Spain has stationed in Iraq when their tour of duty ends in July. Let's see what else is beneath this. This is like surprise to me, opening packages. Oh, yeah, furious Spanish protesters chant, "Our dead, your war." This is what they were chanting at Prime Minister Aznar. They were saying, last night some 3,000 people staged a spontaneous demonstration outside the Popular Party's office in Madrid. So they weren't so popular this time, but that's the Conservative Party. And they were chanting, "We want the truth before voting. Who did it? Our dead, your war. No more cover-ups. And Aznar, because of you, we all pay. Aznar, because of you, we all pay." That was their message. And then, of course, it says here, just in a little note, some demonstrators were beaten by police in riot gear. Sure, what the hell? You know, somebody out there protesting for peace, let's beat the crap out of them. Peter Werby here with you, 313-298-WRIF. I do not think the email is working here. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I can't make it happen in the air studio here at WRIF. Rick Fox, our producer and phone screener for the evening at 313-298-WRIF, can't make it work in there either. So only send me messages if you want me to respond like tomorrow or read it tomorrow. And again, I mean, it says on my website, don't send me stuff from, you know, like Yahoo News or the New York Times or stuff. I've seen that. I mean, there's some people that they must send out 30 forwards a day to all their friends, and I get them all, too. I mean, I read all the mainstream stuff that you folks do. So if you've got, like, some information that you think, you know, there's no way in the world that Werby could have that, send that. Don't just automatically send me, you know, the stuff that you would think that I, you know, I would have. Now, where should we go from here? I don't know. You grab the phones and maybe while I'm mulling this all over. Well, let's talk about sex then, right? And sex has raised its head of the homosexual, or how do the conservatives say it? They don't say homosexual, do they? They say homosexual. We talked about that before. How they must be really freaked about homo milk. I don't know, and I think that's part of the gay agenda to call this homo milk, right? Because why else would they have that? All milk is homogenized, or 99.9% of it. So think about that. Next time you drink a glass of milk, you are supporting the homosexual agenda. Anyways, which the homosexual agenda, by the way, is to be treated equal under our Constitution and be respected as full citizens within our society. Gee, these people are really dangerous, aren't they? Now, you know, I always talk about connecting the dots. If you look up at the sky, you can see just, you know, I don't know, how many stars can we see with the naked eye? I mean, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands, I don't know. And it's all just undifferentiated little dots of light, right? And yet, if you really can use your imagination, like the ancients did, what do you see? Constellations. You can see Orion up there, and Taurus, and, you know, tons of others. Because you got to connect the dots. And most of us, let's not say that. A lot of people, some people, particularly some of the people you can fool all the time, that's all it is, just undifferentiated information when they see the dots of news. And some of it makes them mad. Some of it affirms all the things they want to believe and make, they just want to make certain that nothing ever changes and they can just have their own little life protected by Big Daddy. You know? They used to call it Big Brother, 1984. But really, it's the Big Father figure because it's tough sometimes as these folks sound. They're really scared little boys inside, and they want a Big Father figure to protect them and take care of them. So, but, these lines that connect the dots are kind of arbitrary. I mean, maybe you could just say, we're going to, look it, there's Ozzy Osbourne. That's the Ozzy Osbourne constellation. Because it doesn't, if you look at a bunch of stars, it doesn't look anything more like a bull than it does like Ozzy. Except, we say it does. So, how can you ever prove anything? How can you ever say, this is right, this is wrong? Well, there are some, arbitrators of it all. You and I can stand there and I can say, you're wrong. And you can say, no, you're wrong. And we can't prove it. But in the case of politics, we have a supervisory document. We have a foundation document. It's called the Constitution of the United States. And it provides for certain things and doesn't let the government do other things because the founding fathers were worried about government. They'd never seen a free government, so they're worried about the tyrannical nature of government, which I think is inherent in government. Even this one. Even with the Constitution. Even with the Bill of Rights. But that's another longer thing. So how can we prove, for instance, on the whole question of gay marriage, whether it's constitutional, permissible, or sacred, or whatever? Well, some of what I think the proofs are, you tell me at 313-298-WRIF whether this makes any sense. This was founded as a secular nation, and purposely so, because the founding fathers had seen all these one nations under God. And they knew that heretics were burned at the stake, and there were these religious wars where people slaughtered one another, and there was absolute intolerance between Protestants and Catholics, and on and on and on. It was part of what created civil strife within these countries. They wanted to banish this from the halls of government. That's why they said, essentially what's been called in the Supreme Court decisions, a wall, a separation between church and state. Now comes these hypocritical Republicans who have more scandals in everything from sex to finances than the last 12 administrations put together, and they're the most devout people imaginable. They're in touch with the Lord. And, once anyone tells you that, you either got to reach for your wallet or reach for some defensive instrument. That's what I was going to say. Probably is inappropriate. Anyways, so here's Bush. He's in Colorado Springs. And, this was the man that said he wanted to be elected because he was a uniter. I mean, he wasn't elected. He was defeated in the popular vote, and the vote in Florida was stolen. Mainly because people didn't believe him, that he wasn't a uniter. And he seemed like a conservative, but he didn't seem like the far right-wing fanatic that he and these right-wing wackos that make up his government actually are. So he trots off to Colorado Springs, which is the headquarters of more of these groups, these far right-wing conservative groups that want to meddle in every single aspect of human life and have it conform to what they see as biblical or politically correct or what have you, all from a right-wing point of view. And they want to use the political state to enforce this upon the rest of us. You know, it's one nation under God, which is Iran. You know, that's the perfect example of it. And these ayatollahs and all these Christian conservative groups are cut from the same cloth. And they want us to do, in fact, here, it comes very evident here. Bush assures evangelicals of his commitment to amendment on marriage. Bush assures the evangelicals of his commitment to an amendment on marriage. So here is the, I mean, it's hard for me to say this, but here's the man who is, I don't know if I can do it. Let me try it one more time. Here is the man who is president, assuring a group of the most fanatical religious people in the country that he's going to put through an amendment to the Constitution, altering the foundation document that will have inherent discrimination against our neighbors, our family members, and our friends, because, you know, they're his core constituency. Now, he was speaking via teleconference and displayed on three giant screens in the mammoth New Life Church, and gave a hearty endorsement to the association, which boasts a membership including 45,000 congregations with 30 million members. And Bush said it was founded, quote, with the highest of callings to proclaim the word of God. He added, "You are doing God's work with conviction and kindness, and on behalf of our country, I thank you." Absolutely inappropriate, as far as I'm concerned. Now, he said, he was interrupted by the audience applause several times, "I'll defend the sanctity of marriage against activist courts and local officials who want to redefine marriage." He doesn't like activist courts unless it's the Supreme Court that intervenes in a state election for president and declares him the winner. Then he loves activist courts, you know, all made up of his dad's pals. Where is this here? The sanctity of marriage. So this is where all this, so the religious definitions in a secular nation are going to beginning to creep in here. He says, "Ages of experience have taught humanity that the commitment of a husband and wife to love and to serve one another promotes the welfare of children and the stability of society." Yeah, you know, sort of boilerplate families are good. Well, who denies that? You know, not gay people, not me. But so what do you what really you should do if this is true, that the commitment of a husband and wife to love and to serve one another promotes the welfare of the children and the stability of society, rather than telling gay people that they can't marry, why don't we make a constitutional amendment that says you cannot have divorce? It is absolutely impermissible till both, till death do you part. I mean, you know, the Catholics have it right. No divorce. You have the sanctity of marriage, blessed by the church or any church. The commitment of a husband and wife to love and serve one another promotes the welfare of children and the stability of society. Given this logic, doesn't then the state have a vested interest in not allowing anyone to get a divorce, no matter how much they hate one another? Because you've got to think about the welfare of children and the stability of society. So let all the gays marry. Or at least for you nutball homophobes, that when you say, "Do you know what they do?" You know, we'll just have the women get married, right? Because you love that. I mean, you know, there's tons of pornography snapped up by heterosexual males of, lesbian pornography. So you don't mind that. But let's abolish divorce. But here's the scary part of it. This is the man who's sitting in the Oval Office goes and panders to. Pimps out the White House. Let me panders. That sounds a little too formal. Pimps out the White House for. And that's all he does. I mean, he pimps out the White House at every turn. He's selling the White House, but we'll get to that. Now, here's the slogan on the back of the convention program. This is the Evangelical, where is this here? The National Association of Evangelicals. Here's what they say. What can 30 million evangelicals do for America? Anything we want. That's scary. What can 30 million evangelicals do for America? Anything we want. And they intend a lot. They intend a lot. They want a theocracy. Yeah, this is what, remember, the pilgrims escaped for? I mean, and it's all a load of crap, if you'll excuse me. Oh, yeah, by the way, I'm looking at this photograph. More proof of this. Actually, I'm not getting to my conclusion. Big demonstration at in Boston at the state headquarters where they're debating an amendment to the Massachusetts Constitution that would not allow gay marriage. Here are the signs. No to gay marriage. Yes to Jesus. No to civil union. They don't even want that. No to gay marriage. No hatred, just loving biblical truth. You know, they don't really hate anybody, do they? I mean, if you believe that. I mean, these people are dripping with hatred, dripping with rage. They are toxic to our communities. No gay civil union, over and over again. So here's why I said, remember, how can you ever come to a conclusion who's right and who's wrong? We have a supervisory foundation document that creates a wall of separation between church and state, and the Bushes, well, I mean, he doesn't give a darn about anything, but, and these people want to link inextricably because the sanctity of marriage, what is, you know, sanctity about? I mean, there's no way anybody's able to demonstrate how marriage between heterosexuals is challenged or threatened or weakened or in any way harmed by two men or two women getting married. They just say it. This is going to destroy the institution of marriage. How? I mean, gee, if it wasn't, you know, I'll tell you know, I've been married a long time, but I got to say, if it wasn't for those laws, I would have married the best man instead of my wife. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. So all of this stuff, too. Study finds that teenage virginity pledges are rarely kept. Among teenagers who pledge not to have sex before marriage, a majority do not live up to their vows, according to a national study reported in Philadelphia. Of the 12,000 teenagers included in the federal study, what percentage... Oop, I can't even see Rick Fox here. Let me see here. Hey, Rick. How you doing, buddy? Where do we get our new studios? Yeah. So, of the 12,000 teenagers included in the federal study, Rick, could you hold up your hands and turn, you know, each finger will represent a percentage. What percentage of these teenagers who said that they would, you know, they pledged chastity, what percentage do you think actually did not have sexual intercourse before marriage? What 10%? You got it. Absolutely. 88%. You saw the same article. Now you just know. You've run into those young women who have taken those pledges. I see. Of the 12,000 teenagers included in the federal study, 88% of those who pledged chastity reported that having had sexual intercourse before they married. And the Bush is trying to get how much money? Where is this figure? The White House wants to double to $270 million federal spending on education programs to convince young people that abstinence is the best way. So who gets the money? I mean, you remember he wants to turn it over to these church groups. So it's a way, you know, it's pork barrel. That's the old phrase, you know, just the old politicians in the South, they just bring in a big barrel of pork and say, vote for me, boy, and you can have this big ham hock. Same thing. So he's giving away this money, and it's our money, and our schools are closing, and our roads suck, and, you know, tuition is too high, and when the schools aren't closed, there's too many kids in it. All right, I got a lot more things, and I could go on forever. Oh, yeah, here in Michigan, by the way, thanks to a minority, but just enough to turn back an amendment to the Michigan Constitution that would have banned same-sex marriage. At the same time, there's a move afoot, as it frequently happens, to install, amend the Constitution again to allow for a death penalty in Michigan. Michigan has never had a death penalty since it became a state. It is an honor among the states to have never had it. Absolutely, you know, for punitive reasons, for deterrent, all of that. It just doesn't work. Prosecutors don't want it. At one point, they were going to bring it up during Boy, isn't it nice? I can't even think of that loser who was the governor before Jennifer Granholm. Hey, I can't. That's nice. Engler. Yes. Engler. Right. Thank you. I didn't remember. I like it when those things won't come to my mind, because that's like mind pollution. But anyways, he, you know, conservative Republican, he was against it. It cost too much money. He put, you know, people wrongfully put to death. It's a nightmare. I mean, it's being this effort now is being put together by the father of this slain Detroit police officer, one of them. And one understands that. I mean, if you've had your child taken from you in this manner, and someone says, I think we have a law that ought to torture people to death in the most hideous manner, you'd probably say, yeah, you know, I want some vengeance for my son being taken. But that's not the kind of state we want to live in. We live in a state that has the honor of never having had an execution ever. In, when was Michigan? Was it 1837? Something like that. All right. You talk to me, Peter Werbe, 313-298-WRIF, and let's go right to the top. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Pete. Dave from Detroit.
Hi, Dave.
Yeah, I've got a comment. You know, seems to me since Bush and he's rattling the saber with his war with terrorism in Iraq, seems to me there's a lot of bombings and terrorism stuff, not necessarily Al-Qaeda, but all kinds of stuff going on in these countries that have never had any problems before until now. And, you know, I'm just, like, curious, you know, what the average Joe in these countries think about what's going on? You know, I've talked to a few people that travel around a lot, and they say the Americans' popularity is not too good in some countries, but there's a lot of countries that, you know, I haven't ran into anybody that's been to them, but, you know.
Well, Dave, thanks to Bush, we're roundly despised. You know, he's hated, but Americans in tons of countries are just absolutely thought of as terrible because, for some reason or other, mainly because of the way these news outlets that have portrayed Americans as 100% behind George W. Bush, which of course was just part of the big lie.
And I'm sure most of Europe and everybody else is well aware of his ancestral ties to the Nazi Party, whereas most Americans aren't.
That could be. I mean, because, a lot of dealings there that are pretty shady. You know, there's a new book out, which I can't get my internet up, so I can't report it accurately, but it's like something like Bush Clan, Saud clan, how the Bush family is so tied in with the Saudis and that they've shipped close to $2 billion to the Bush family over the years. So,
and then,
yeah.
And then when he, in April of just before 9/11, he signed, 43 million over the Taliban, and then at the end of the year they're behind the terrorist attack, and then he's paying the Northern Alliance to get rid of the Taliban, which was the $42 million to get rid of the Northern Alliance earlier in that year.
Yeah, you'd almost think it was a racket. Well, folks, if you're thinking, what the hell is Dave talking about? In, what was it, April or May of 2001, Bush okayed $43 million of our tax dollars going to the Taliban because they had eradicated, absolutely eradicated, poppy production, which was the basis of, which is the basis of heroin. So we rewarded them with that. Paid them off. And, of course, now that we have our buddies in the Northern Alliance, that democratic group of warlords, in Afghanistan once again leads the world in poppy production. Thank you, Dave. Last week we were talking about, did George W. Bush have a brother that was involved in security of the World Trade Center? James, who is listening in Kenosha, Wisconsin, he says, Marvin P. Bush. Some of you are saying, Marvin P. Bush, who the hell is that? You know, he's got some brothers, but they don't let Marvin come around, and they sure don't let that crook Neil Bush, his other brother, come around. Anyways, according to James in Kenosha, Marvin P. Bush, the president's younger brother, was a principal in a company called Securicon that provided security for the World Trade Center, United Airlines, and Dulles International Airport. And it comes from a website called whatreallyhappened.com. You want more on 911, by the way, and Bush involvement, go to my website, peterwerbe.com, peterwerbe.com, and go to the 911 logo. It's incredible front page that takes you to the 911 page from the New York Post that says Bush knew. All right, let's move on. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Well, hi, this is Scott from Westland, and I guess, you know, I've got just got a couple jokes for you about this gay marriage thing, you know, for one thing.
Do I want to hear them, though?
No, that... listen, you know, you sure, of course you do. Okay, all right, you know, conspiracy theory. You know who's really behind, you know, this gay marriage thing? It's the Trial Lawyers Association, because if there's going to be gay marriage, there's going to be gay divorce.
Gay, and there'll be gay divorcees.
No, I got another joke for you.
That was a joke? I thought you were leading up to it. Go ahead.
No, I was leading up to that. You know, I was leading up to, you know, like, you know, the big money conspiracy theory, you know, but, you know, okay, you know, all right, you know, like I said, I think this whole gay marriage thing is an afterthought. You know, it's a Band-Aid or something like that. The real critical issue that I'm a little wavering about is about, you know, gays raising children. But again, like then... Then again, you know, like I said, if there were famous people who were, like, standing up for this, I would say that, you know, how about, you know, I was raised by gay children. I'm Steve Forbes.
Well, I don't know where you're going with that, but obviously there's enough horror stories of heterosexual families and straight parents doing the most hideous things to their kids that to accuse gays of being unfit. Hey, I just saw Birdcage last night with Nathan Lane and what's his name? All right. Thank you. Appreciate your call. Okay. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. It's Funky. How you doing?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Somebody from Boston wrote me about your call last week.
Okay. Well, I just want to make a couple points in observations, if I could.
Sure.
I want to make at least an initial point. It seems like, as far as when people give kudos to you, akin to Rush Limbaugh, they're usually on air for, at least when I've tracked it, anywhere from a minute to 5 minutes.
You're gonna actually prove your point unless you get onto something more interesting.
Absolutely, Peter. Because usually, when somebody that opposes you that gives you a legitimate argument, they get about
10 seconds. Well, let me bring up what you said, and I kind of just hung up on you last time because I was really somewhat offended by your call. Whereas you said that you oppose gay marriage because I was saying, you know, one, it's not going to hurt the sanctity of marriage, it's not going to stop heterosexual marriage or heterosexual relationship. So you brought up the point that there was a financial aspect that could in fact hurt Funky, right?
Well, yeah. That, not only that, Peter, but the time before that I called, you actually instructed me never to call your show again.
So, oh, I never said that.
Absolutely.
I never said, wait, what are you talking? I mean, you know, this is, your call is so self-referential that it's getting boring. So let's talk about issues. So you said that, and I forgot what the convoluted logic was, that somehow this could wind up costing you money. And on the way home, I mean, I usually don't think about calls or what have you, but I didn't think I answered that well. Because, really, it would be like some segregationist in the South in 1958 saying, well, you know, it's not like I'm too much opposed to Negroes, but if we have integration, it's going to cost me a little more money. Because, actually, I was benefiting from discrimination against people in our communities. So there's really no different, you know, you're saying, you know, screw other people that want equal rights because, you know, some phantom belief that you are going to be charged more money for something. Whereas really, I think it's just a dodge for homophobia.
And the funny thing is, Peter, you repeatedly make my point for me. I mean, I don't even have to say anything and... You make my point.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
Men, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Here's a thought, though.
Yeah.
I never thought about getting a bigger house until I met you.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, we can help you with that.
Because of what I've learned about mortgages from Rock Financial.
And why wouldn't you? If you take advantage of interest only and the smart arm and you get a bigger house, guess what happens? Your home will appreciate more. You'll make more money over the long haul. You always do with real estate. Very safe investment.
I know. And you don't want to be tied into something like an apartment that eats your money and gives you nothing in return.
I feel like a little disrespected that some of our listeners are still renting.
Yeah, I know. They should get into this maybe smart arm. Do you think they could qualify?
I think everybody's qualifying for the smart arm, but I don't know why they're not listening. We need more calls to figure out how to get more renters into becoming homeowners. You know, the national average is moving up, and we got to get everybody on the bandwagon. Regardless of your credit, make a call to find out if you can do something. It's a good idea.
The first step is with a Rock Financial mortgage expert. 800-333-ROCK or visit them online at rockfinancial.com. Put that on your list of things to do and dial 800-333-ROCK.
Actually, the first step is to listen to us. The second step is the call.
That's right.
There we go.
Rock Financial, a Quicken Loans company, equal housing lender.
Looking for the right mix of on-road handling and off-road capability? Look no further than the versatile Jeep Liberty. From the city to the country, Liberty comes well-equipped with standard features like air, power windows and locks, remote keyless entry, and now one extra comfort. A great deal. Now, qualified returning Daimler Chrysler employee lessees can lease a Liberty for just $189 a month for 39 months with $2,134 due at signing. Tax, title, and license extra. Plus, you'll also get great protection, including the security of our 7-year or 70,000-mile powertrain limited warranty. So get into this great $189 a month lease on Jeep Liberty by getting to your Chrysler and Jeep superstores today. Call 1-888-299-JEEP for lease example details. Offer may require dealer participation. Residency restrictions apply. Take retail delivery by April 30th. See dealer for a copy of limited warranty. Transferable to a second owner with a fee. A deductible applies. Jeep is a registered trademark of Daimler Chrysler.
His name is Marcus Allen Washington. Today is his birthday. He weighs just 1 pound, 3 ounces. A breathing machine helps him breathe because his lungs weren't developed before he was born. If you could see this baby, you would see him wince in pain. He lies on his back, connected to tubes and drips and medicine. This is one of the possible effects of smoking during pregnancy. Call 1-800-537-5666 today for your free expectant mother's quick kit. It's designed specifically to help women who are pregnant or are planning on becoming pregnant soon to quit smoking for good. You may not worry about what smoking does to you, but think about what it could do to your baby. Quit before you get pregnant, or if you are pregnant, quit now. Call 1-800-537-5666 today. No one should be born a smoker.
This message brought to you by the Michigan Department of Community Health and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
Hey, Dave, what's going on?
Not much with me, but it looks like lots going on at Mr. Jones. This place looks awesome, man.
Yeah? I thought you knew. That guy Michael Abrams, who owns Snooker's Pool and Pub, just bought Mr. Joe's.
Oh, Mr. Joe's was okay before, but now it's great. It has new plasma TVs and big screens everywhere. Before you know it, this old sports bar will look brand new.
Cool. We'll never miss a game, and we still get great food. There's nothing like a Mr. Joe's burger.
Oh, new TVs, new menu. Mr. Joe's sure is a sweet place to hang out with friends. Oh, hello. I think maybe we'll be making some new friends here, too.
Oh, yeah. I think we'll be spending some time at Mr. Joe's.
Be sure to visit one of Snooker's 5 locations on St. Patrick's Day for free pool all day long. You must be 21. Get your green beer at any Snooker's, McVee's, and Mr. Joe's on 12 Mile in Southfield. Snooker's Pool and Pub, McVee's, and Mr. Joe's. Great places for a good time. Guaranteed.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF.
If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
Thank you very much. Welcome back, and welcome to all of you listening around the country and around the world on WRF.com or radiopower.org. You can also go to radiopower.org tomorrow, Monday, when the show is repeated. And you can see all the times there as well. Also, archives at White Rose Society. And that's all. If you go to my website, peterwerby.com, and then go to On Air or On The Air, whatever it says, it'll get you there. And, hey, we got our email back. So you can email me about the subjects we're talking about or anything else. And we're talking about the religious basis of opposition to gay marriage and has no part in framing policy for a secular country like ours. And, all right, so that's that argument. Also, events in Spain, so tragic, so terrible. And politically, first victim, first foreign policy blowback of George W. Bush's ill-fated attack and occupation of Iraq. Next, I predict, will be Tony Blair. And the final pin to fall, thankfully, will be George W. Bush this November, unless they manage to steal another election. As they did. All right, let's continue onward. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Oh, this is Greg from Hazel Park. I have a couple comments for you, actually.
Sure.
One, I'm a little upset that you constantly group all the Christians together saying we're all right-wing and believe that the amendment should be put through about gay marriage. I don't believe it's right personally, but I don't think it's my right to tell somebody else that they can't do it. And there's a lot of us Christians that feel like that.
I know. And in fact, I think that's one of the problems with this, probably is even a minority of Christians who really are conservatives. That's what marks them most. I don't know. But no, all of the, even listen, the Christian peace and social justice people that I know, even the Catholics, which don't think that homosexuality or divorce or abortion are right, and they pray about that. They don't want the political state to enforce their religious beliefs on people that don't share it. They hope that people would come to their belief, but it's through gentle persuasion. So if I gave the impression that I was trying to tar everybody with one brush of intolerance, I wasn't communicating well, and I apologize to you and to others that may have taken offense.
Okay. The other comment I wanted to make is, although I don't believe that we should, that the state, local, federal, whatever government should make a law on gay marriages, the ones that have, I would urge, instead of going, like in, I think it was San Francisco, they were giving the gay marriage licenses.
Right, with a number of places, yeah.
Those people should be going to the courts, fighting for their rights to do it. Go take it to the Supreme Court, because they're the only ones that can change this law that's in the books
mm-hmm.
now. And if they did that, I'd be all for them. If it's, but otherwise, just going and having a city official break the law that's in the books, that's not the right way to go about it. We set up, like you said, the Constitution so that we can change the laws here so that we have a Supreme Court that interprets what's allowed by the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't they take it that route instead of try and convince these city officials to break the different laws.
Yeah, I don't think they had to try very hard with the mayor of San Francisco or New Paltz, New York, or the county commissioners in Portland, Oregon. I mean, there's like this groundswell of this happening, particularly in areas that have high gay populations. And, I mean, it does remind me somewhat of, not, I mean, the parallel isn't exact, but of the civil rights movement of the late 50s, if you remember reading about that, when there were all these laws that enforced segregation, and some of them had even been upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States, because up, from 1896 to 1954, separate but equal segregation was allowed. So people began doing essentially civil disobedience, going into lunch counters, and they probably could have sued and maybe even would have won. But there's just something when these popular-based movements get rolling, they kind of have a mind and a way of their own. I mean, I know what you're saying.
I have one question for you, though.
Sure.
If this did come down to a vote, I know that the amendment doesn't come to a personal you-me voting. It's more the state senates that vote.
Right.
But if it came down to a vote in the state of Michigan, for instance, and the popular vote in Michigan said we don't want gay marriage, would that be, are you saying that's, would that be wrong if the populace as a whole wishes that?
Well,
and not just one minority.
I'd never like to have anybody's rights or status as a citizen put up to a popular vote. You may have heard me last week where I was saying, or I was quoting this poll from, I think it was 1958, that 96% of white people in 1958 opposed interracial marriage. And there, and it was against the law in any number of states up until 1967, that late. So if you would have voted on whether people in love of different so-called races, you know, the overwhelming majority of the white population would have voted against it. So, and people change, societies change now. I mean, there's still, it's like 76% of the people approve it. I mean, I don't know who these nutballs are, the 24%. That don't approve. I don't approve of colored and white mixing. You know, I mean, what the hell is that? Maybe they just, you know, we keep them around as sort of museum pieces. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I grew up with my parents telling me, you can't date anybody of a different ethnicity. I couldn't date Hispanics or African American or something like that. That was very frowned upon in my household, and that wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. Well. I mean, a lot of times people still would like an Italian family wants, you know, the daughter to marry a nice Italian boy, you know, a Jewish family wants a nice Jewish girl. Yeah. So that's not unusual. Or a Presbyterian, if it's a little less ethnic, a Presbyterian would like you to meet somebody from the church and all. So that's not unusual. But we live now in a time where, you know, that mixed race is not an epithet any longer, but sort of an interesting amalgamation of a lot of the people that have populated this country. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Appreciate you spending time with us. 313-298-WRIF. I did say, didn't I? Yeah, that our email is fixcalltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And here's our next caller. Hi, WRIF. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, good evening. A couple comments, and first I'd like to start out by saying that I completely agree with what you're saying, that, I mean, in a secular society that we live in, or a secular country that we live in, Bush's faith-based initiatives are crossing the line. If anything, he's probably disguising what actually needs to be done. As far as him promoting abstinence until marriage, that's fine, but if he's promoting it because it's a religious belief, he's going astray. If he's promoting it as a means of teaching personal responsibility to the youth of America, and then that's the way he should go about it. And the thing is, by having sex before marriage, as long as you're going about it in a responsible way, keeping from like having a child by using contraceptives, whether it's by the female or by the male, again, it should be more a question of personal responsibility than just abstinence, black or white.
Yeah, yeah, sure, absolutely. Well, part of it is like I said earlier, that what it, I forgot the figure, what was like almost $300 million of our tax dollars that are being used for this abstinence teaching program that is an absolute colossal failure. It has a worse record than the DARE, you know, drug programs.
Oh, exactly. It's a waste. And the thing is, now that you brought up DARE, it shouldn't have been a question of, okay, drugs, okay, of course some drugs are just obviously harmful to your body more than anything that, I mean, heroin's a perfect example, not just taking it, I mean, not from personal experience, but just from what I was taught, just the, like, trying to break the habit of using heroin is 100 times worse than trying to break the habit of smoking cigarettes. But the way they went about it in school, I mean, I'm a 22-year-old student, so this is still in recent memory for me. As far as how they went about teaching or, like, keeping kids away from drugs, they made it such a dark issue where they didn't approach it a little bit more, and you can only approach it as mature as the audience. But I mean, when I was in school, I remember them saying, "Oh, if anyone approaches you with like offering you drugs, turn the other way." Well, you can also look at it, okay, the person's being courteous. I mean, if you want to look at it in a benign way, mm-hmm. They're being courteous. They're just sharing with you. If you say no, that's fine. Just learn to be confident that by saying no, you're not doing anything wrong. And if that's not your peer group, I mean, you have to teach kids the like the way to be, like deal with rejection. So if you don't go along with what your friends say and then they reject you, teach them that, all right, well, rejection is a part of life.
Well, also, if you have friends that that'll reject you because you're not following everything, whether it's style or music or drugs, you need some new friends. I don't know whether you misspoke yourself or not, but cigarettes are harder to kick than heroin.
Well,
wait a minute. First off, cigarettes have the highest addiction rate of any drug. You know, in terms of, it's almost 100% use to addiction, where I don't know, I can't remember what it is with heroin, like 50% or something, you know, it's way below that. And you go to, like any, Narcotics Anonymous thing, and everyone's smoking, not everyone, great numbers of people, because they, you know, they're addictive personalities, and that's why, they get strung out on drugs in the first place. And, two things, I mean, nicotine is a legal drug, the most destructive of all, that all the rest of them put together just pale beneath the death and destruction and, you know, ill health and community costs that we suffer because of this legal substance. And there was a second thing. What was it? I don't know.
No. The second thing I was going to mention, it was on the subject of the gay marriage.
Yeah.
Again, that's another faith-based initiative that's crossing the line in the secular country that we live in. If you want to say that something's immoral, that's one thing. That's subjective, and that's also a reflection of the society that you live in.
Mm-hmm.
However, for it to be against the law, again, that's the same thing with abortion. Abortion, again, this is a touchy issue. I'm completely against it because I feel that's immoral. If it's a way of escaping your responsibility. If you participate in the act of bringing a child into this world and you just want a quick way of getting out of it, well, abortion is not the way. I mean, at very least, put the child up for adoption.
Well, I mean, on issues like that, we all have our opinions. The only thing I've been saying all night is we just don't want to have this, our particular moral ethical stance in the world be generalized against the will of other people who don't share that. All right, thank you. I have to move on. I appreciate your call. And I rarely ever give the last name of people, but in some ways this is a great compliment because I mentioned earlier radiopower.org that streams this program live and then repeats it on Mondays. And I mean, this is an incredible site. I mean, I think it's got over 1.5 million people listening to it or throughout the day. Anyway, Shelby LaPree is the head of it all, and she wrote in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Peter, I think the rash of, quote, illegal gay marriages were simply civil disobedience, no different than, no, I won't go to the back of the bus. Yeah, I think so. I think you're absolutely right, Shelby. And thank you for your opinion, and thank you for your support of this program. I really appreciate it. All right, another call. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, good evening, Pete. This is Sal from Wyandotte.
Hi, I didn't get your name.
Sal from Wyandotte.
Sal.
Yes.
Okay, hi.
I want to change gears just briefly because I have to get your opinion on something.
Sure.
Somebody brought up to me today the fact that the explosion in the railway system in Spain occurred Thursday. I think that was March 11th, 2004. And if you go back from September 11th to now, exactly 911 days, and I'm not someone who pushes conspiracy theories at all, but I just really want to get your opinion on that. And I did the math and even included the 29th of February that occurred this year for the leap year. So
I think it was. I'd seen that before, and that's not a conspiracy theory, and it could be people that put a great amount of emphasis on symbols. In other words, they attacked on September 11th, they attacked the symbols of American military power and of financial power and, you know, this huge megalith of the World Trade Center. And very possibly the other one was going to the congressional building or to, you know, the Capitol or to the White House. So the idea that this is just another reminder from Osama bin Forgotten, but he's back in the news because of this, and also, oh yeah, you know, actually there was some other thing, I didn't read him all this, but yeah, no, I think it was 911 days.
You almost feel like this, I guess this parallel. I agree with you with the symbolism, and let's kind of put the high level of coincidence aside. It almost seems like a serial killer-esque pattern. I mean, you're starting to see a kind of a pattern that's emerging from this, either this person or this network of people that exactly are trying to drive a message home.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe it drives all the code breakers and, you know, in the federal government crazy to figure out what the next plot is or whatever. But
no, do you think it was just a coincidence that it was done on September 11th, which is 911? I don't know if it's outside of North America, but is the number we call in the case of emergency.
Exactly. So rooting from the very beginning of it. No, I totally agree with you. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of symbols that are kind of intertwined there. Just a thought.
Yeah, just a thought, an important one. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Yeah, this is more corruption in government. I don't think I have enough time before our break. But this U.S. announces new offensive against Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan because things, just like the Soviet Union, when they were fighting the combination of the people that are, you know, the Northern Alliance and the Taliban. American military officials announced Saturday that they had mounted a new military operation against fighters for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in eastern and southern Afghanistan. So the idea of a government, the Karzai government, the president of Afghanistan, sort of a joke. He's kind of like the Duke of Kabul, you know, the capital city. But here, this is interesting. Listen to this wording here. Defense officials in Washington have said in recent weeks that American forces are adopting a variety of new tactics in Afghanistan as warm spring weather approaches. Now, here is the important line. Capturing bin Laden is believed to be an election year priority for the Bush administration. Capturing bin Laden is believed to be an election year priority for the Bush administration. It's in the middle of the article, and it's easy to go right over it. Think of the cynicism there. It is an election year priority. It's not a priority to stop Osama bin Laden from, either for if he, you know, I mean, are we, what, 10% sure, 99% sure that he was behind September 11th bombings? You know, we all take that for granted. It's not never clear to me how this was 100% sure thing. But let's say he was. And he's said he's going to do more. Lots have happened. And now we have Spain, which we're seeing Al-Qaeda was behind. So, wouldn't that be a little more of an intense reason why Osama bin Laden should cease being Osama bin Forgotten? Well, suddenly he's going to be the card to play because the capture of bin Laden is believed to be an election year priority for the Bush administration. Do you know, other than giving away the nation's economy to the corporations and Bush's wealthy contributors, other than attacking the rights of women, the rights of the middle class and the working class, of attacking the environment, of attacking overtime, of attacking Social Security, there's not a thing that the Bush regime ever does that does not have a political content to it, that isn't all for show, that isn't to fool the passive masses, you and me, or so they think. I mean, everything from landing on aircraft carriers to phony setups with, you know, in St. Louis with boxes saying made in U.S. that were actually made in China. It's all photo op. It's millions and millions of dollars raised to the point where now, let me see, what is it? Thought I saw some figure. Yeah, Bush, as of this week, has raised more than $159 million. He's raising $600,000 a day. This is the fundraiser-in-chief. This is government by auction. And it's all from the people that are fleecing us, the pharmaceuticals, the banking, the people that are just raking in the bucks because they have G.W. Bush in office.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
Do you feel like half the man you used to be? Do you feel tired and irritable? Are you losing your sex drive? If so, you could have low testosterone.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. Testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35, but now you can boost your testosterone naturally. Introducing Testostazine, the powerful new testosterone-boosting system I developed for men who are starting to feel their age. Testostazine supports your body's ability to produce testosterone the way you did when you were younger, so you can restore your energy, youthful sex drive, and staying power. Testosterone keeps a man energetic and sexually confident. You can feel that way no matter what your age. Testostazine can help.
Call now for your risk-free confidential trial of testosterone. Call 1-800-807-8108. 1-800-807-8108. Guaranteed to work for you or your money back. Call 1-800-807-8108. Results will vary.
Hey, this is Meltdown for the Rift, plugging Joe Pannion Chevrolet. And I gotta be honest, I don't just endorse anybody that wants to come on the station, alright? I'm proud to be associated with the guys from Joe Pannion Chevrolet, the unbeatable dealership, giving you an unbeatable price on a Chevy. Check this out, a 2004 Silverado lease, $213 a month, no down payment, just sign, crank that bad boy over, and drive a true piece of Americana right off the parking lot. You can customize your truck as well, wood grain dash packages, custom wheels, DVDs, subs. Of course, you got to have the rumbling exhaust system. You want people to know you're coming in your Chevrolet. And hey, if you work out of your truck, Pannion can upfit one with racks, plows, spreaders, anything you need for your job. Joe Pannion has it. Smoking deals, man, this month. Silverado for $213 a month or less. Call 866-JOE-1111. Bring any quote in on a Chevy and tell them Meltdown says to beat it. They're online too, theunbeatabledealer.com. Check out Joe Pannion's trucks. You won't want to go anywhere else. Chevrolet, an American revolution.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine Online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like Cafe West, specializing in fresh seafood, saltwater fish, Angus beef, wild game, and poultry, located on West Jefferson in Trenton. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine Online.
It's all from a station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, Detroiters' number one choice for square deep dish pizza since 1946. Visit the historical 6 Mile and Conant location today.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Hey, Dave, what's going on?
Not much with me, but it looks like lots going on at Mr. Joe's. This place looks awesome, man.
Yeah? I thought you knew. That guy Michael Abrams, who owns Snooker's Pool and Pub, just bought Mr. Joe's.
Oh, Mr. Joe's was okay before, but now it's great. It has new plasma TVs, big screens everywhere. Before you know it, this old sports bar will look brand new.
Cool. We'll never miss a game, and we still get great food. There's nothing like a Mr. Joe's burger.
Oh, new TVs, new menu. Mr. Joe's sure is a sweet place to hang out with friends. Oh, hello. I think maybe we'll be making some new friends here, too.
Oh, yeah. I think we'll be spending some time at Mr. Joe's.
Be sure to visit one of Snooker's 5 locations on St. Patrick's Day for free pool all day long. You must be 21. Get your green beer at any Snooker's, McVee's, and Mr. Joe's on 12 Mile in Southfield. Snooker's Pool and Pub, McVee's, and Mr. Joe's. Great places for a good time. Guaranteed.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. This is our second and final hour. Please join us. And I got some interesting interviews at 1 a.m. coming up Eastern Time here about crime, corporate crime, and how you actually, as the lone citizen, can bring to heel some of these corporate criminals that are ripping us off. And also then another conversation about the individuals that run afoul of the law and what happens to them when they try to reintegrate into, what do we call this out here, minimum security prison, I guess. Huh? What's going through my brain? Let me see. Well, I'll tell you what we've been talking about. We've been talking a little, again, about gay marriage and how it's inappropriate, in my estimation, some of you have been agreeing, in a secular country to invoke religious arguments. Like we, let me see if I grab this, hold on here, I'll just grab it again. These people picketing against gay marriage, no to gay marriage, yes to Jesus. No hatred, just loving biblical truth. No to gay civil union. So they're trying to impose religious beliefs on our secular laws. People that love each other and want to get married. And these awful people, including the man in the White House, wants to institutionalize in our foundation document people that are told, not only are you not equal, no, not only will we not recognize your love and commitment to one another, it never will. Just like you can't have slaves. It's on, you know, like wanting to, you know, you think about that message there. By the way, Vice President Cheney's daughter is gay. I wonder what she thinks. Oh, it's just dad, you know. In any event, like you can't have slavery in this country. It's on a par with that. You can't have, that's the amendment they want to put in. You can't have gay marriage either. It's that awful. It's on a par with slavery. Boy, these people are horrible. Absolutely horrible. I'm remiss to have not mentioned this coming up next Saturday. It's going to be massive again. Haven't seen much of the anti-war movement. It hasn't gone away. Certainly been active in communities all across the country, all across the world. And now on the year's anniversary of Bush's illegal, unconstitutional, and unnecessary war, the war that began with a lie, no weapons of mass destruction. March 20th, the world still says no to war. You can go to my website, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. 13 cities in Michigan so far are having events, including Royal Oak, Ann Arbor, Lansing, around here. And on my site, it says Plan One in your community as well. So it's a National Day of Action, pardon me, against war and occupation in Iraq. And if, you know, there's so many people that tell me all the time how much they enjoy this show. Now, this is, let me apologize in advance. I'm going to give you a little bit of a harangue. It's not going to be real bad, so don't turn it off or anything, because nobody likes to be harangued. I'm not grabbing you by the lapels and saying this, but one of the reasons that people tell me they appreciate this program is because they hear views that they hear nowhere else. Because there's this monolithic corporate conservative party line. You know, the ruling class, the ruling elite, the Republicans and their sidekicks, the Democrats. That's as far as you're ever going to get, you know, in this society. So you say you like this. Well, you got to do something as well. If you don't like Bush, if you don't like the way this country's hung together, if you don't like the way this world operates, you got to do something. It ain't going to happen by me talking on the radio or if I had a 7-day-a-week program and broadcast for 8 hours a day. It's just thoughts. It's just ideas. It has to be put into action. And the word demonstration, what is that? It is a demonstration of your feelings en masse. In Spanish and French, and the word is always something like manifestación, right? It's a manifestation of your ideas, of your beliefs, of your ethics, of your commitments. So make it real. Or you can just go to unitedforpeace.com. Or is it .org? I can tell you in 1 second here. Whoa. If I don't, I think I can. Hold on. Let me click it again. .org, unitedforpeace.org, or you can go through my site as well. I'll tell you everything that's happening all across the, and if you're listening elsewhere other than the Michigan area, if you go to unitedforpeace.org or to my website, you can just put in your zip code and you can see the hundreds of actions that are going to occur across our country and the hundreds and hundreds that are going to occur across the world. So, be part of it, I would say. So, closest thing you'll ever get from me to a harangue. Or is it an harangue? Any event, 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werbe with you here on Night Call. And yeah, line three it is? Yeah. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I just wanted to call and talk about gay marriage.
Sure.
I, first of all, want to tell you that I swear I thought it was crazy, and then I heard your radio show, and it's just like me and my mom aren't crazy anymore. Because everything that you say, I'm just nodding my head while I'm driving home from work. I'm like, oh, God, this guy knows everything. It's so true. Everything's true.
Well, I don't know everything. If you and I, no, because if I'm saying just what you believe, you know as much as I do.
I've been, like, on hold for a while, and I have heard the calls that have called in, and I agree with so many things that these people have been saying. Like, you know, especially with the separation of church and state, you mm-hmm. know, with this, oh, God, oh, hate the gays, love Jesus thing, you know, and it's so irritating because, like, how can we welcome people of different religions and different backgrounds if we're just going to say, okay, if you're not Catholic, white, and right, then you're nothing?
Right.
You know what I mean? And what really bothers me about the gay marriage thing is about, you know, nobody's going to talk about giving selective rights to certain people. You know, we had this whole segregation thing going on, and we, you know, had the whole everybody hated the Japanese Americans when Pearl Harbor was going on, and we're giving rights to certain people when it's convenient to them, to the government.
Sure.
And this is happening all over again, but they're not going to talk about segregation, and they're not going to talk about Pearl Harbor because now, you know, quote-unquote, Whitey isn't doing anything wrong this time, you know, because they're like, oh, well, this is different. This is a religious thing, blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah.
Hey, what area of the city do you live in, or the, you know, around the city?
I stay in Hazel Park and Melbourne.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Hazel Park isn't very far from Ferndale and Royal Oak, and...
And yeah, I actually grew up here in Hazel Park.
Okay. Well, you know, there's gay churches, gay Christian churches
mm-hmm.
in Ferndale and in Royal Oak, and... So, and there's a lot of liberal Christian churches. I think it was Greg from, in fact, it was Greg from Hazel Park.
Yeah.
Was taking me to task because he thought I was, you know, brushing all or painting all the Christians as being intolerant with the same brush, and that's not true in the slightest.
Oh, for sure. I know people that are like, oh, I'm gay and I'm totally in touch with God. But, see, when people think of God, they think that you have to believe what everybody else believes. You know, and I was getting into this with a girl at work. She's 16, and she thinks she knows how the world works
uh-huh.
and how, you know, she thinks what her mom thinks, basically. You know, and she's like, well, I think gay marriage is just sick. I saw these people kissing, and they were gay, and it was so gross. And I was like, okay. And she's telling me this, and I'm just like, you know, you wait until you're 50 and then come back and say something because you've lived.
Well,
you know, I've got, you know, 6-7 years on her, and it's just, you know.
Well, you know, the big word is aesthetics, or which just really means taste. I mean, everybody has their own taste. So if somebody is offended by people of the same sex kissing, then they are. But you can't make a law because because something is displeasing to you.
It bothers Bush. It doesn't matter that he's in a seat of power, which he really isn't anyway. It's everybody else.
You know what? Let me ask you a question. I just had a thought of this. This varies from family to family. In our family, the men kiss on the cheek. So, like, I kiss my father on the cheek, and he kisses me. On the other hand, there's people that have married into our family where I see the father and the son, you know, in-laws, where the father and the son shake hands.
Mm-hmm.
So is that odd? I mean, is it odd that I kiss my dad and my dad kisses me?
No, the Italians do that. You know what I mean? Like, I've
yeah.
seen it all the time because I work in a place where we get a lot of different cultures, and people will be really happy to see each other, and they'll kiss each other on the cheek. And it's not even, sometimes it's not even a real kiss. It's like an air kiss, and they just brush cheeks.
Yeah.
And that's not weird. I've seen it all the time, but our family's the same way. My dad and you know, his brothers or whatever, they shake hands, and then they hug.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
well, there's
my mom, we hug.
There's different levels. I mean, there's somebody in my family. I don't think they're listening. They live in another city, and I'm sure they're asleep by now. But, I mean, like years ago, I gave them a hug, and it was like even, whoa, you know, it was like, I don't, you know. So,
Cookie Monster.
Yeah, so I just shake his hand now. And I always wonder what he thinks. I mean, we've been there. My dad and I I don't see him all the time because he lives in a different city. So I see my dad. I throw my arms around him. We kiss each other in the cheek. And my relative, his father says, hello, son, and they shake hands. So,
well, God forbid if you actually did that in front of the girl from work, she'd be like, oh, my God, that is so sick. You know what I mean? And that's not wrong. And people who love each other, as an American citizen, being a citizen is like being enrolled in a union without having a choice. You
yeah.
pay taxes, which aren't even legal anyway.
What?
Taxes yeah. are, you know, that... Totally just boggles my mind, but it's like being enrolled in a union and not having a choice. You pay your dues for what? So they can just do whatever they want when they think it's okay.
Right, let's not get off on that.
And they laugh at me. Whenever I have a problem, they're like, oh, blah, 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 give me some foo-foo dust. You know what I mean? So So it's, they do whatever they want when it's convenient for them, and nobody ever talks about whatever happens. You know what I mean? Why are we U.S. citizens if we don't have the rights as everybody else? A citizen should have the rights as everybody else. You know what I mean?
All of a sudden, wait a minute. I'm still stuck on men kissing men. There's a guy I know. I don't think he's done this in years. But every time he'd get plastered drunk. I mean, and this guy was a real guy. Always had a lot of girlfriends and all that. But every time he'd get drunk, he'd start French kissing all of us. You know, he'd throw his man, I love you, and you know, and then he would.
Well, you know, he could have had all those girlfriends because he never wanted to admit it that he was gay.
I don't think he is. But one thing that struck me is men have the biggest tongues. Never mind, I won't even ask you. I said, damn. I mean, how do they? And women are, you know, are like usually smaller than men. And I'm thinking. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Bye, dog.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Appreciate your call. I don't know if we even want to go there. We can go there if you want. But it was always the strangest experience. And the other thing is, too, usually when you expect to kiss people, when I, as a man, expect to kiss somebody, they have a smooth cheek, right? Because they're a woman. And having a guy with a rough beard putting his tongue down your throat. I think he drinks less now, so problem solved. Anyways, you know what? I survived. You know, the world didn't come crumbling down. I mean, I might, you know, I'll tell you the truth. I mean, I'm so ornery. Here's my, let me see if I can put this all together. If I wasn't married, which I am, married to a woman, and I think, what do you think about this, Rick? You hear, if I wasn't married to my wife, I can't even say it, even though you can. They say it on television. P.O. I'm old school. I can't do it. Just to P.O. like conservatives, I'd marry a man and, you know, with my arms around, hugging a tree, and then go burn my bra. Yeah. and they would say, see, we knew he was a freak. We know he was a freak. I'm a freak. So, you know, so what? Let's move on. I still get mail. I mean, people all the time say, I've been listening to you since I was, you know, 9 years old. So a lot of you know me. But every once in a while, people say, I've heard this, heard your show for the first time. Yeah, let me see. And there's a letter here. Yeah. Heard you for the first time, and they tune it on, and there I'm saying, I'm going to marry a guy and hug a tree. Oh, whatever. Ed writes from Denver, Colorado. Ed was a first-time listener. Maybe after this will be the last time. I don't know. But he doesn't say that. He wrote to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, I'm listening to you for the first time tonight and enjoying the reasonable and rational points that you are making. Well, maybe not the last stuff. Lately, says Ed, Bush has been saying that Kerry wants to raise everyone's taxes by rescinding Bush's tax cuts to the wealthy. People should consider whether we should shoulder the deficit burden now or pass it on to our children, grandchildren, etc. It seems irresponsible and cowardly to pass it on to the next generation. Well, to be sure, because just like native people always said, you got to make decisions like you're making it for the sixth generation. Bush and his pals, Bush Co., they make decisions for the next financial quarter. That's it. Just the profits. After us, the deluge, right? Said Marie Antoinette. Now, here's the deal. So people should consider whether we should shoulder the deficit burden. Now, I don't know, you know, you were very nice at not going on at length, so I don't know entirely what you intended here. But we, the great we, the vast majority of the people, shouldn't shoulder the deficit burden at all, now or the next generation. It ought to be shouldered by the people that can afford it and that were affording it before Bush drove this country into debt by his giveaway of tax breaks to the wealthy that have barely touched the middle class and do nothing for the working class. So since they benefit so greatly to the point where they're willing to put up almost $160 million to elect their representative, the corporate representative, the representative of the corporations. Now, Bush is not the representative of the people. He was rejected by the majority of people in 2000. Only through a con game was he placed in office by these other representatives of the corporations, his dad's pals on the Supreme Court. So Let them pay the cost. They can afford it. And hands off Social Security. Right now, Social Security is fine. And you get Bush's pals, others of them, like Alan Greenspan, who wants to reduce Social Security. That's going to be, you know, if it happens right now, it'll be for your parents and your grandparents. If it happens in a, you know, in a few years, it'll be you. And you're going to be paying off the deficit as well. So your taxes will be real high to repay the interest on these loans that the United States has had to secure in order to keep doing business, because Bush maxed out the credit card by not taking in enough revenue. What's the difference? I mean, either you're spending too much or you're, you know, you're not making enough. And so your tax dollars, rather going for national health programs or good schools or roads or, you know, whatever else we'd like to increase the quality of life, instead you're going to be paying foreign bankers off the interest. You know, all we're doing is paying the interest on our card. Same deal. And then when finally you retire, there won't be that much there and you'll have just this pittance. Well, you can get used to anything, including cat food. Hi, it's WRIF and you're on the air. Good evening.
Peter, this is Ed from Novi.
Hi, Ed.
First, I just wanted to know from you, did you watch 60 Minutes this afternoon?
I didn't. Tell me about it.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sure you're familiar with the subject. I wanted to get your thoughts on it. To sum it up real quick, they were bringing up the subject again about the drugs from Canada and how blatant the government is, and especially, you know, with the Republicans controlling the executive branch, allowing drug companies to just put on any price they want for the drugs, you know, for the prescription drugs to the American public, and yet they're regulating the drug prices in Canada at affordable rate, and the FDA is trying to tell us that, oh, the Canadian drugs, they're not good to come over here and blah blah blah. But you know, when every time the certain people from the Congress try to step up and say, you know what, let's get the drugs in Canada or let's get some price regulation on these RX drugs, it seems like it's nothing's happening, and we're just paying millions of dollars, and the seniors are getting hurt the most.
Well, they sure are, and it is. And I, you know, this sounds like hyperbole, like I'm exaggerating when I use this word, but I mean it in the most precise sense. It is criminal that the drug companies, with their inflated prices, that eventually then, you know, they're part of the whole process that drives up healthcare for all of us. But the price of drugs literally leads to the death and the unnecessary death and the premature deaths of hundreds of thousands of people over the years, because what happens in order to afford these meds that are so outrageously priced, that aren't about healing people but are about selling drugs and profiting from the sale of drugs for these pharmaceutical companies' stockholders, people cut their meds in half, or they take them every other day, or they just don't have the money at all, so maybe they're going to skip a month. Well, when you have high blood pressure or life-threatening conditions like that, you say, oh, well, so-and-so died of a stroke or a heart attack. Well, it's poor old Sam. That's too bad. He was only 58. Yet if he would have had access to the kind of medicine that is available to everyone else in every other industrial country, that wouldn't have occurred. Also, it winds up costing all of us more money, because if you don't have health insurance, people then hold off going to doctors until they can't function. Oh, I got a bad pain in my stomach. Well, you know, if I get a bad, you know, something odd happens to me, a lump or a pain or, you know, something's happening odd, I'll mark it down and I'll say, okay, it's Wednesday, what is this? It's Monday the 15th right now. So I'll say, I'm going to check this out on Monday the 22nd. And if it's still there, then I'm going to go to the doctor, even though I'm not feeling any particularly adverse symptoms. But if you're poor and you're one of the tens of millions of people without health care in this society, you go, oh, well, I got a pain in my side or stomach or a lump or a bump or something like that. And all of a sudden, the first time you go to see get medical care is when you collapse. So, this is Murder Incorporated. That was the name of a group of assassins for the mafia in the 1930s and 1940s. And that's what the pharmaceutical industry really is, Murder Incorporated, because they have their choice of administering carrying out, talk about sacred, a sacred duty, that is in the sense of coming to the aid of other people that in our society that are ill or trying to maximize profit. And they go for the last. They, in other words, they will deny people medicine because the people don't have the money to pay. And if you say, either I need this or I'm at risk for a stroke, they say, we're really sorry.
Oh, I one other thing, too, is I just want to get your comments on. And when they were doing the story, they said on average, not every drug, but on average, drugs in Canada are half as less as what they are here in America. And they said by bringing the drugs from Canada over here and allowing us to buy, to purchase them, that would balance out these drug companies that are just gouging the public. But the government in Spain, mainly under the executive branch of George Bush, won't allow it, and that just blows my mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely inconceivable. It blows my mind that we don't have a national health program, that everybody doesn't have access to health care as a matter of right. I mean, if you're going to create this vastly unfair distribution of wealth and income in this country, at least we should take care of the people that have been forced, out of the well-waged healthcare-provided employment situation. All right. Thank you so much, Ed. I appreciate you calling 313-298-WRIF. Let's see here. Case writes in, I read a CNN online article this week about the U.S. military deploying high-tech surveillance equipment on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border to watch for bin Laden 24-7. He asked, why did it take 3 years to get involved in the search? Is it for the October surprise? The October surprise is what the Republicans have frequently pulled right before elections. That's how Reagan scammed into office in October of 1980, which is a long story, probably too long for the telling now. I don't know. I wonder what the reaction will be. We've talked about a little about this. I mean, what's Bush going to do? Is his popularity ratings drop? Even his supporters, many of his supporters are beginning to turn on him. So let's say in October they catch bin Laden. Are people going to say, oh, this is, all of us would be happy to, particularly if we can demonstrate that he is the key behind all of this. I mean, it'd be terrible if he was just one among many plotting these horrific, attacks on civilians, but I don't know that there's not too many people in this country that would not be overjoyed to see bin Laden captured. But how many people would not think that this was purposely designed to come about at that time? Maybe even to the point of it would have a reverse effect. So you catch him in July. How much of an uptick in popularity does Bush get from that? Didn't get much from capturing his dad's old buddy, Saddam Hussein, did he? Rumsfeld's old buddy, Saddam Hussein. Oh, you know, get this. One of the, the huge liars in this all, Rumsfeld, let's see, 7 U.S. soldiers killed in the weekend bomb attacks in Iraq. I mean, you know, we don't even mention that anymore. 7 possibly young people I see now, ages, the only place you ever see a list of the U.S. Dead, never the wounded, the thousands of people that have been wounded over there, but is in the New York Times. Anyway, 7 U.S. soldiers killed in weekend bomb attacks in Iraq, a number of others wounded severely. Those wounds, I think it was even something on the front page. Where did I see that about? I can't remember now where it was wounded. How about this? Army sent mentally ill troops to Iraq. There's been this huge rash of suicides, people there and coming back. But the Army appears to have inappropriately deployed soldiers to Iraq who already were diagnosed with mental problems, according to documents obtained by United Press International. U.S. families are beginning to protest the war. Those who lost loved ones in Iraq join in dissent. The timing coincides with the White House PR campaign. Now, there's been 3,200 wounded Americans, 560 Americans killed, and these families that have lost children are beginning to take part in the anti-war movement, including a big one. Where is this happening? Oh, they're going to U.S. Air Base in Dover, Delaware. Pardon me. There's another one. coming up at Fort Bragg on March 20th. All of that you can go to unitedforpeace.org. Now, this is from buzzflash.com. Rumsfeld is on Face the Nation, and he says, Bob Schieffer says, well, let me ask you this, to Rumsfeld. If they did not have these weapons of mass destruction, though, granted all of this is true, what does that mean? Why then did they pose an immediate threat to us in this country? Rumsfeld, well, you and a few other critics are the only people I've heard of use the phrase immediate threat. See, they're denying now that they ever said it was immediate a threat or imminent threat. I mean, absolute lies. Absolute lies, right? They all said that. We know that. And Schieffer says, you're saying that nobody in the administration said that. I can't speak for nobody, everybody in the administration, and say nobody said that. The vice president didn't say that, says Schieffer. Rumsfeld, not if you have any citations, I'd like to see them. Then it goes on a bit. Let's see, where is... we have one here. It says, some argued that the... and this is you speaking, Secretary of Defense, that the nuclear threat from Iraq is not imminent, that Saddam is at least 5 to 7 years away from having nuclear weapons. I would not be so certain. So he's saying that we wouldn't be so certain. Rumsfeld, and someone else says, and it was close to imminent. Rumsfeld, well, I've tried to be precise. I've tried to be accurate. In my view of the situation was that we believe the best intelligence we had and other countries had, and that that we believed and we still do not know, we will know. Whew. You don't want me to repeat that, do you? These are the people in whose hands our fate lies. George Bush, Rumsfeld, Cheney, everything they've ever done in political or private life have wound up in wreckage. Their businesses, their political decisions, and they've done it again. And thousands are bleeding. American troops are wounded. Iraqi civilians have been killed in the 10,000-15,000. Thousands more are wounded because, oops, we didn't say immediate. We didn't say imminent. Yes, they did. They're lying. We know that. All right. Are we still going to line three, or did we do that? All right. Hi, WRIF. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Hi.
Well, good evening. This is John. I'm calling from Riverside, California.
Well, welcome, John.
On radiopower.org.
Wow. And thank you to them. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Getting back a little bit to your, the religion and politics and the gay marriage and everything. As far as a gay marriage, I honestly couldn't care less one way or the other.
Yeah.
But as an atheist, I am appalled by these so-called Christians forcing their beliefs on me every single time I turn around.
Give me some examples, because we had a couple of... I mean, for one thing, I don't know about you, but all the Christians I know, every single Christian I know is a liberal.
Yeah, I know a few liberal Christians, but mostly, starting off with the president shoving religion down our throat with his faith-based initiatives and everything. I don't want my tax dollars going for that stuff.
No, I don't. Not only do I not want it, it's forbidden by the Constitution.
Well, it's like he doesn't. He seems to think he's above the institution, and that's what makes him even more dangerous than anything.
Well, John, if God was speaking directly to you and through you, you would have a bit of arrogance yourself.
Yeah. Well, you know. Being that, as far as I'm concerned, he's
I hope it's a decent one.
Superstition.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I can't believe that these folks have any genuine beliefs at all. That when Bush has all these these expressions of faith and all that they just I can't believe that that the people that make up the Bush administration believe in anything other than power and wealth. That's what they worship. They worship mammon. Mammon. What is mammon? Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. As Tom Hartman says on his show, with all the corporatism, by the very definition of the word, they are fascists.
That's right. I mean, that's kind of a long explanation of all that. But you can go to tomhartman.com, any way you spell it. Actually, his name is spelled T-H-O-M-H-A-R.
I already have it bookmarked.
Yeah, okay. Well, I didn't mean you. I was telling the rest of the audience. I'm an old pal of Tom, and I've interviewed him a couple of times in the interview segment of my show. He's a great guy. Also streamed on radiopower.org, by the way.
Yes, he is. Also, I don't know if you know this disc jockey out of Los Angeles on KLOS 95.5, Jim Ladd.
Jim Ladd, he's not a talk show host. He's a rock and roll guy, isn't he?
He's a rock and roll guy, but you and he must be cut from the same cloth because your political beliefs are almost identical. You should hear some of the rants he goes off on Bush and Christian conservatives, et cetera, and so forth.
On his music, I mean, doesn't he do like classic rock?
Yes, he does.
But he inserts. You know, I'd like to do that. I mean, mix. You know, if I was doing this like 5 days a week, I always got more than I can talk about. But I was doing 5 days a week. I could easily do like half music and half talk. I'd love to do that.
Yeah, I'm an old rock and roller that goes way back.
Well, thank you for joining us from Riverside, California. Thanks for listening on RadioPower.org.
No problem. I've been listening to you for about a month now.
Well, thank you, John.
Take care.
Bye now. Riverside, California. Man, we were getting all this cold weather. Just talked to friends, went out to San Francisco for a conference, and it's unseasonably warm there, 75 degrees. I don't get this, but I'll read it all the same. Justin wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Does the problem in people not having any money have something to do with them not balancing wants and needs? I don't know. I don't get it. I'll think about it.
Neo's Cucina Italiana with three locations in Farmington Hills, Dearborn Heights, and Dearborn.
You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com.
Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Let Dr. Roach put your best pace and body forward with help from Dr. Roach.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We had Fox 2's Dina Senafani on to discuss anchor Charles Pugh coming out to say he's gay. Well, I made the big mistake of bringing up the vet.
How could you not tell us Charles was gay?
It never came up.
It never came up.
Had you guys said to me, you know, does Charles have a girlfriend? I would have said, no, he's gay.
That's true.
How's it been going?
It's going well.
Nice piece on Dr. Bankstall, too, by the way, that great vet.
Yes.
He's got this big activity center for animals. They have, like, these fancy beds and small
boring
chairs.
Is this something you thought would be good for your dog?
Patricia's dog.
Oh, Patricia's dog.
Not for my dog. You're not trapping me in that.
You have the cutest little dog.
Oh, wait. Darling.
I need to know something, Dina. Does it say, this is Mike Clark's dog? Or does
yeah.
It does.
Really?
It doesn't say, this is Mike and Trish's dog, or this is Trish Clark's dog?
I think it says Mike Clark. WRIF 101.
You know, Charles Pugh, the gay story, just pales in comparison to the fact that we now know there's a picture of a dog labeled as Mike Clark's dog at the vet's office.
That dog is no German Shepherd, I'm telling you.
No.
Foo-foo.
Are you kidding? You're not kidding.
Go on, Dina, stop it. You're doing terrible damage.
Drew and Mike in the Morning. Broadcast program. On the Riff.
101-101.
Riff.
showing Bush sitting in the classroom while the Trade Center burns. Maybe a split screen showing Bush duly sitting on one side and the towers burning and people jumping to their deaths on the other. I know it's harsh, but it's the truth, and I think it'll get the point across that if this is a war president, Daffy Duck should replace the eagle as our national symbol. I'll tell you, Bill, there is actually something out already having to do with that. If you go to my site, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E, go to the 911 site, and then I can't remember which, but it's a video. I mean, it's astounding. I mean, Bush knows that the trade towers have been hit and continues reading the story about a goat to these kids. Now, the official explanation, and he tells different stories afterwards about when he knew about it. He says he didn't know about it when he actually did, and why he never gave the approval for the shoot down of those planes is something that's never been adequately examined. In fact, also on that 911 site on mine, the 911 page in mine, there's a whole list of unanswered questions about September 11th and the Bush complicity. Either malfeasance or misfeasance, depending on how you're going to cut it, that have never been answered. Now, let me see one other thing. Oh, yeah, yeah. The official Bush explanation as to why he didn't stop reading to these kids that, well, here, the trade towers are in flames. People are jumping to their deaths. People know about this all over the country, are beginning to see this on television, and Bush spends 20 minutes reading a story about a goat to these kids in Florida. And he says, well, he didn't want to scare the kids. Now you think, oh, God, you know, what a compassionate man. He is a compassionate conservative. What a load of crap. I mean, if you didn't want to scare kids, you say, kids, I got to go. I got to do something else. I wanted to read you the story. I love you. We'll see you. You're not going to say, kids, we're under attack and you're all going to die. That would scare him. He'd just say, I have to go. I'm the commander in chief of the armed forces, and I have to go give the okay to the fighter jets that may have to shoot down these planes, which he never gave. So even if there would have been a scramble, and these planes did not get in the air to way after one would have thought they would have been able to do, so these planes, even after people, and you know, they knew they were hijacked, there never was a presidential order saying these could be shot down. Now there is. Now I think they even have somebody in there other than Bush that can do it. But, you know, there's too many unanswered questions. Too many unanswered questions about September 11th. We're going to line one, Rick. All right. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, this is Sue.
Hi, Sue.
Hi. You mentioned the incident in Florida, and I was watching the Fifth Estate, and they had a video of Bush saying that he saw on television in Florida, the first plane hit the tower.
Yeah, another lie.
That's a lie.
Yeah.
It's just Bush being Bush or what? And I think it's outrageous that he's only going to spend 1 hour with the 9/11 commission.
Yeah, no, it's I mean, that's been a fraud for from the beginning. Remember which was one that just crashed? Columbia or the Challenger? Which shows the latest crash of those? The Columbia, right? Yeah. Anyways, they had the Columbia crashes. They do this investigation. They spend millions of dollars on it, and then figure out, gee, it's an old space shuttle, and they ought to reexamine the whole deal. September 11th has been going on now. You know, it's going to be going on 3 years, and Bush does not want the results of this to come out before the election.
No.
Yeah.
What about Louis Free? He quit 1 month before 9/11. What did he know? What didn't he want to be part of?
Yeah.
Another thing with this whole gay marriage thing,
uh-huh.
You know, he's alienated us from the rest of the world, and now he's just trying to alienate us from each other. And, you know, retarded people get married in this country.
Right.
Who cares? You know, these aren't people that need our time and energy. You know, let's concentrate on the homeless, our vets, you know, people that need our help.
Sure. You know what, Sue? I don't know if you heard at the beginning of the show. When I was quoting Bush, was saying that keeping families, traditional families together was important for our children and for our nation. And I said, well, if that was the case, maybe they should say that divorce is illegal, that we, you know, like in a number of Catholic countries, because We have to stay together. Right? I mean, right now, 50% of all heterosexual couples part company.
No, I don't want the government in my life.
Absolutely.
You know? And I find it outrageous that marijuana is not legal by now.
Well, we are.
And liquor is.
Well, let's not segue into too many different subjects, but
okay, I just don't like the government.
Well, I know.
In my life.
But it's the conservatives. I mean, they're such hypocrites. They say they want to keep the government off our back. I don't want the state in my life, and I certainly don't want religion in my life unless I decide, to do so.
Right. Well, it's like Abraham Lincoln. He said that the role of the government is to help those who can't do for themselves. Leave everyone else alone, you know?
Yeah, I got you. Thank you,
okay,
Sue.
Bye.
Appreciate it. Listening in Auburn, Alabama is Micah. He says, I've listened to you for about the past two Sundays from WRIF.com through my broadband connection. Glad to finally hear a radio talk show that isn't from the far right. All we have on the radio down here, Limbaugh, Hannity. Since Bush has gotten in office and given his tax cuts, our tuition at college has risen almost every single year. Our governor, who was known for voting down every single tax increase that came his way while he was in Congress, tried to pass the largest tax increase in state history as one of the first things when he took office in 2002. It was voted down by the people of Alabama. That's how bad it's gotten. Bush cuts the federal taxes and the states have to pick up the slack. Thank you, Micah. Thanks for listening to the show all the way down there. Leslie, thank you so much. Rick Fox. Rick, not on the air tonight. Not rocking you. Does our friend go by the name I usually call him by? Is that what he said? Tiny. Tiny will be on the air rocking you. IWRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, this is John from Detroit.
Hi, John.
Hey, I wanted to talk about some of these ridiculous 9/11 scenarios.
Yeah.
Just today I was running across on the Democratic Underground that Let's Roll 9/11.org came up with that they had missiles on the passenger jet that went into the WTC.
Wow.
All right. I mean, previously it was no plane hit the Pentagon.
Right.
They had concurrent explosives inside the World Trade Center that went off when the planes hit, and now it's missiles. And I'm thinking that not only is somebody putting out some sort of thing that the Rush Limbaughs and Sean Hannitys can come back and say that liberals are crazy and insane, and therefore you can ignore everything that there is about 9/11 that they're saying, and then they come up with these well-funded websites that show up with bizarre things happening.
Well, let's do what do they say in college? A deconstruction of this. So what's going on here? You have all these people. The same thing happened like with the Kennedy assassination. Didn't look like only one guy could have done it. And some early researchers, or actually one early researcher, Mark Lane, put together a fairly plausible conspiracy theory for, what had happened. And what couldn't have happened, even though the Warren Commission said that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin. Well, it became an industry. And pretty soon, the conspiracy to assassinate Kennedy, in some people's minds, involved hundreds of people, and hundreds of people had also been killed in order to keep this hushed up. Now, here's what happens. Here's what I think in terms of, getting at its components. People are saying things that on the face of it, and on those websites, and it doesn't take much, you don't have to, cost you a couple hundred bucks a year. You don't have no big financing. Is that people, when you don't have trust in the bureaucracies that rule your life, you begin to suspect them of anything and everything. And so what's happening, rather than an orderly process of trying to get to the bottom of all this, you have, by stalling this. So, I mean, we should have had a report like 6 months later. So people's imaginations or people's fantasies begin to rule rather than, I'm agreeing with you to some extent, rather than, a calm, rational investigation. You know what I'm saying?
I hear you.
But you don't agree.
Well, the books like from France that came out.
Yeah.
You had three different books, and I forgot their names now.
I forgot them too.
Forbidden Truth, I think.
Right, that was one.
And this was a good book about 9/11 and how it really pertained to the Saudis and so forth. And then suddenly there appeared the Siri Mason book, The Big Lie. and it seemed to be like it was done by somebody who was had a lot of money and could go in there and set up this book, buy all the books back up again so that it looked like a bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
And then, it gives Rush Limbaugh the ability to go in and say, oh, these liberals, they're crazy.
Well, you know, but let me, I guess I'm just repeating myself. If there would have been an earnest and authentic investigation of this and a speedy one, all of the rest, I think it would have come out real bad for Bushko. And because here, well, I mean, based on what? This is a lot of what I'm going to say is supposition. You tell me, you may think I'm one of the nuts, but let me just tell you in a few sentences. I think that there was long-range plans on the basis of these neoconservatives based around this project for a new American century to gain the United States a presence in South Asia and in the middle of Middle East, particularly Iraq. And what they were looking for was the excuse that they needed. That there was, and I'm willing to bet you dollars to donuts, this will all come out eventually, that there was plans that as soon as there was an attack, any place in the world on an American asset, that the United States would attack and occupy Afghanistan. That I'm, I part company with anybody who says that the Bush gang planned this, or they purposely let the attack on the World Trade Center happen. But one thing is clear: they absolutely ignored all the intelligence that was being given them by Russian intelligence, German, Israeli. That Bin Laden was making threats in June that there was going to be a major attack on the United States, and it was like they said, "Okay, once it happens, then we are going to make our move," and they did. So that's and let security be as lax as possible. I mean, why wasn't there the kind of security that we have now present immediately upon hearing all these threats?
Way too many questions, aren't there?
Yeah, well, that's it. And you know, if you go to my 911 site, it is filled with probably a lot of rot. Which I'm not taking responsibility for at all. But the longest article in there is from the Philadelphia Daily News, a mainstream corporate newspaper that's entitled Unanswered 9/11 Questions by, sober, responsible corporate journalists. And, they're kind of frightening when you think of the implications of some of the answers.
The 9/11 Commission just got an extension. Do you think Bush is going to go in and testify soon?
Well, as Sue said, he's going to testify for about an hour in secret. I don't know, is he going to be testifying under oath? I don't know.
No, I think he said he won't testify. He's going to visit with them.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Isn't that nice? Thank you, John.
So
appreciate it. Thanks for joining us. More calls? Are we okay, we got time for one more. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Al from Inkster. How you doing?
Hi, Al.
I need to correct you on something. Whereas the state of Michigan has not executed anybody and we've always not had capital punishment,
right?
There have been executions in the state of Michigan.
Well, not in the state, when it was a territory.
Within the state. The last one was 1934 down in Milan. They hanged a bank robber from Midland, Michigan.
You're right. Actually, that was a federal
execution. Yeah, it's all been in the federal system.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you are right, sir.
Secondly, I have one related thing. If, they're going to bring this religion down on us, let's make adultery a capital crime.
Sure.
We execute 40% of the population that's committing adultery. We don't have to worry about the jobs that are being outsourced because there'll be plenty of openings.
There you go.
Modest proposal.
A modest indeed. Thank you, Al.
Bye.
Appreciate it. Thanks for listening to this segment of it. Stay tuned. Got a lot of interesting interviews just ahead, and we'll talk to one another next week.
Thank you very much for joining me.
No. That is the interview itself. Here we go.
Okay, so I was talking to the guys at Motown Harley-Davidson the other day, and they told me that they were helping out the Illich Children's Charity sell raffle tickets for a brand new fat boy. I thought, now who would want a big old slob living at their house? The guy at Motown said, no, a Harley Fat Boy motorcycle signed by all of the Red Wings. I felt like so dumb. Then I found out that on Monday, February 15th, Mickey Redmond and Karen Newman are going to be at Motown to help sell the raffle tickets. I said, no way. And the Motown guy said, yeah way. And I said, no way. He said, yeah way. And I said, Okay. So on Monday from 5 till 7 p.m., me and my Harley-Davidson motorcycle are going to be chilling with Mickey and Karen at Motown. I can buy a raffle ticket for all of my friends, trade Bingo Bango stories with the Mick, and, you know, well, maybe sing her a song or two with Karen. It could happen.
For sales, specials events, or just to look at cool pictures, log on to MotownHarley.com. Motown Harley-Davidson in Taylor on Telegraph, just north of Eureka.
Hey, buy a raffle ticket from Karen and Mickey at Motown, okay?
Hey, Napoleon, where are you going?
I'm going to Waterloo to meet my enemies.
But you could get defeated if you go there.
Who cares? It's over for me anyway. My wife, Josephine, she's divorcing me. She has this tough lawyer who wants to take everything. My palace at Versailles, all the fancy medals I win.
Oh?
Even my faithful horse, Pierre.
Well, there's no reason for a man to lose his home, his children, his money, or his self-respect.
Oh?
Now, Adam is here to protect you. Adam is the American Divorce Association for Men.
Ah.
They're a group of highly qualified divorce attorneys and counselors who will defend the rights of men in any divorce case.
Ooh.
Adam will answer your questions about divorce at no charge. Call the American Divorce Association for Men.
Hello, this is Napoleon the Great speaking.
Who is that, you nappy dolly?
Josephine, what do you want from me now?
Adam is handling your divorce.
Yes, so?
Well, maybe after you conquer the rest of Europe, we could have lunch. I mean, it's nothing to lose your head over.
Call Adam at 248-356-ADAM. That's 248-356-ADAM.
Hey, this is Meltdown from the Rift, plugging Joe Pannion Chevrolet. And I gotta be honest, I don't just endorse anybody that wants to come on the station, all right? I'm proud to be associated with the guys from Joe Pannion Chevrolet, the unbeatable dealership, giving you an unbeatable price on a Chevy. Check this out, a 2004 Silverado lease, $213 a month, no down payment, just sign, crank that bad boy over, and drive a true piece of Americana right off the parking lot. You can customize your truck as well, wood grain dash packages, custom wheels, DVDs, subs. Of course, you got to have the rumbling exhaust system. You want people to know you're coming in your Chevrolet. And hey, if you work out of your truck, Pannion can upfit one with racks, plows, spreaders, anything you need for your job. Joe Pannion has it. Smoking deals, man, this month. Silverado for $213 a month or less. Call 866-JOE-1111. Bring any quote in on a Chevy and tell them Meltdown says to beat it. They're online too, theunbeatabledealer.com. Check out Joe Pannion's trucks. You won't want to go anywhere else. Chevrolet, an American revolution.
Do you feel like half the man you used to be? Do you feel tired and irritable? Are you losing your sex drive? If so, you could have low testosterone.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. Testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35, but now you can boost your testosterone naturally. Introducing Testostazine, the powerful new testosterone-boosting system I developed for men who are starting to feel their age. Testostazine supports your body's ability to produce testosterone the way you did when you were younger, so you can restore your energy, youthful sex drive, and staying power. Testosterone keeps a man energetic and sexually confident. You can feel that way no matter what your age. Testostazine can help.
Call now for your risk-free confidential trial of testosterone. Call 1-800-807-8108. 1-800-807-8108. Guaranteed to work for you or your money back. Call 1-800-807-8108. Results will vary.
Good morning. This is Ray Vinson of American Equity Mortgage. If you're hearing our message at this time, it's probably because you're at work, driving around, or can't sleep. If you can't sleep, I hope it's not because of money problems, but if it is a money problem, American Equity Mortgage can help. You're not alone. The average household has a credit card debt of $6,000 or more and paying a fortune in interest. You see, if you're a homeowner, you can use the equity in your home to consolidate all your bills and have only one payment. Think about that, just one new low monthly payment. Your equity can be used to pay off your auto loans, credit cards, and get a new low fixed rate on your mortgage. You will be saving hundreds of dollars each month. American Equity Mortgage specializes in homeowners with less than perfect credit. We have helped thousands of people just like you get back on track. You can call our office right now, and a loan specialist will call you first thing in the morning. That's American Equity Mortgage. Call toll-free 888-71-LOAN-1, 888-71-LOAN, then the number 1.
Come see what's new in boating at the Spring Boating Expo, March 18th through 21st at the Novi Expo Center. See hundreds of ski boats, fishing boats, runabouts, pontoons, and personal watercraft with great prices and low interest rates on new 2003 and 2004 models, many under $200 a month. Buy now for your best savings, plus a great selection of lifts, docks, motors, trailers, electronics, clothing, and accessories. Don't miss the catch-and-release fishing at the Kids Trout Pond and a chance to win an $18,000 boat, motor, and trailer package from McMacken Marine and Four Winds. For great family fun, it's the Spring Boating Expo, so you're ready to hit the water when the boating season starts. For more information, call 1-800-224-3008 or click on mbia.org. The Spring Boating Expo at the Novi Expo Center, March 18th through the 21st. Sponsored by the Oakland Press.
Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby, on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Thank you very much for joining me. You know, whenever there's a period of crime in any city, I mean, certainly the cases here in Detroit, when there's a spate of murders or other crimes, people always start saying, throw the book at these criminals. That's the problem. Justice is not swift enough, not harsh enough. And if you locked up all the criminals, I mean, some level, it seems to make sense. If you locked up all the criminals, then there wouldn't be any crime. It wouldn't be the perpetrators, that small percentage of people, even in the poorest neighborhood, that make life miserable for the rest of us. Well, there's a story here, and it's contained in an extraordinary book. It's called Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett, and it's written by journalist and author Jennifer Gonerman. Jennifer Gonerman is a staff writer for the Village Voice in New York, and she has reported on the criminal justice system since 1997. She's had articles in the New York Times Magazine, Vibe, The Nation, The Source, Newsday. She's won numerous awards. And Jennifer Gonerman, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Is this your first book?
It is my first book, actually.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I've never had a book. What's the feeling when, I mean, I've done a lot of journalistic articles, and nice to see your name up there. It only stays for a week, though, right?
We're trying to stretch it to be a little bit more than a week, but the book just arrived in bookstores within the last week, actually. So the hope is that we can, you know, create a little buzz and keep it at the front of bookstores for at least a month here.
Well, I meant when you do, like, Village Voice articles, it lasts for a week. This,
exactly.
That's what
exactly.
I meant. So
okay.
So this is sort of this is going to be there in 100 years in a library.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, tell us about Elaine Bartlett, Life on the Outside, the prison odyssey of this woman, like how the whole, how this began as an article and became a book, and how you came across Elaine Bartlett.
Sure. I met Elaine Bartlett back in 1998, and at the time she was locked up in Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, which is the only maximum security prison for women in New York State. She had been there for 14 years, serving time for a drug crime under the Rockefeller drug laws, which is New York State's drug laws, their mandatory minimum sentences. She had received a sentence of 20 to life for selling 4 ounces of cocaine to an undercover police officer in a setup operation. She'd never been arrested before, but because of the way the mandatory sentences work here, she got 20 to life. By the time I met her, she was in year 14. I interviewed her. I was doing a piece about the Rockefeller drug laws at the time. I never imagined that I would stay in touch with her all these years afterwards or that there would ultimately be a book about her life.
How did that happen? Why? What was there that made it more than some paragraphs in an article?
The first time I met her, I was very, I found her to be a really compelling person. I mean, partly the facts of her case, you know, first-time offender, 20 to life, were pretty amazing and memorable. But it was also something about her that really drew me to her. She's a very, I think anyone who reads this book will see, a very straightforward, blunt, honest person, not afraid to tell the truth, which is the kind of person that any journalist really wants to interview. And I also felt like every time I listened to her, and I did stay in touch with her over the next couple of years and did a couple more stories about her for the Village Voice, I learned a great deal from listening to her. I felt like she was a really important voice to have in our national debate about crime and punishment. You know, as a society, we're always taught that the experts are the people with the PhDs, the people who have first-class educations. And here was a woman who had spent 14, 15 years in prison, and I felt like, in a lot of ways, she was ahead of the national debate. She was 5 years ahead of the national experts in terms of framing and articulating a lot of the problems of the inner city. She ended up getting clemency from New York's Governor George Pataki in her 16th year, so that was back in the year 2000. And I ended up following her over the next 3.5 years after her release. And the book, Life on the Outside, basically describes her struggle to rebuild her life after after losing 16 years and spending those years in prison.
You know, it's interesting. Ann Coulter, who I'm sure is going to be someday exposed as actually a transvestite. Not that there's anything wrong with that, as Seinfeld said, but she said that when she was talking about the Rush Limbaugh's addiction, and she said, liberals have finally met a drug addict that they don't like. So the conservatives would say, why a sympathetic portrayal of Elaine Bartlett? We had what was called a scourge of drugs during the 1970s and the 1980s. There was an attempt to stem this. These were people that were ultimately part of a whole chain of crime and what have you. Why not just condemn her to the hottest room in hell or at the prison she was in and be done with it? Why a portrayal that gives her fleshes her out as an entire human being?
Well, the book isn't entirely sympathetic, but it does try to do what you just said, which is flesh her out as an entire human being, warts and all. The Rockefeller drug laws were enacted in 1973. The governor then was Nelson Rockefeller, New York State, and they really helped to launch a national drug war. They were the first, New York was the first state in the country to pass mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes, and every state basically followed suit, and the federal government, setting up mandatory sentences for drug crimes. In New York State, and in many states, the severity of one's penalty for committing a drug crime is not based on whether they're a kingpin or a first-time offender. It's based on the weight of the drugs, the amount of drugs involved. And that's how we have this woman here who had never been arrested before end up with a 20-to-life sentence for her first crime. And so the book isn't really intended to sort of, it does acknowledge the very serious problems that drugs have caused in a lot of different communities, but at the same time, it also raises questions about when does the punishment fit the crime and when does it not fit the crime.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer Gonerman is my guest, and she's written Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett, and it is published by Ferreira, Strauss, and Giroux. And just hitting the stands, available right now at good bookstores around town. Michigan, by the way, had something that they called the 650 Lifer Law.
Mm-hmm.
So never having been involved in a drug trade, I can't do the math on that. What does that turn out to be in terms? Do you know that 650?
I don't know many ounces? Of the details. I mean, I'm sure many of your listeners could answer this question much better than I could. But I know that Michigan did, like New York State, become in some ways notorious for having very, very strict drug laws. And I believe, is it correct that Michigan's reformed their drug laws in recent years?
Yes, finally.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And in New York State, that hasn't happened at all. The Rockefeller drug laws, just as they were passed in 1973, were modified slightly in the late 70s, but since then there's been no reform. And a lot of activists in New York have been trying to go the way of Michigan to try to add a little more rationality to this picture and to really reform the drug laws. And it really hasn't happened here in New York State yet.
I thought it, that shows how behind or, I don't know, uninformed, I guess, is the word for me. So people, if a first-time drug offender with a certain weight can still get 20 years to life?
Yeah, in New York State, it's if you are arrested for selling at least 2 ounces or more and or possessing at least 4 ounces of cocaine or heroin, and you're convicted of that crime, you serve a mandatory 15 to life at least.
Boy.
And in Elaine's case, she ended up with 20 to life because she had a particularly strict judge. But that law hasn't changed in 30 years here. And just in the last few years, Michigan and about half of the states in the country have reformed their drug laws. You know, they have sort of backpedaled, moving away from these mandatory minimum sentences and putting a little bit more, thought into the effect that these drug laws are having. But New York State has been very, very reluctant to do that, despite the fact that our governor, George Pataki, has promised to reform the laws over and over again. It hasn't happened in New York, at least not yet.
Well, I always make the joke, probably inappropriate when we're talking about what has happened to so many human beings. I say, well, war on drugs. I can't even drive on drugs. But it was, and I guess is, still part of what was initiated at the time. The war on drugs, was the harsh sentencing successful at all?
Well, I don't think so. A lot of people will tell you that the drug problem isn't much better now than it was then in terms of the quantity of drugs coming into the country. But what has happened is that America now has more than 2 million people locked up, many of them for drug crimes. We've got the highest per capita rate of incarceration in the world. And the result of such tough-on-crime, quote-unquote tough-on-crime policies, is that we now have a record number of people leaving prison, and that's what I try to explore in this book, Life on the Outside. This year, we're going to have about 630,000 people coming out of prison. That's more than the population of Seattle, more than the population of Boston, more than the population of D.C. And so there's incredible numbers of people coming home to neighborhoods, usually the same neighborhoods they left, often in worse shape than they were when they left. So what's going to happen to all of these people? How are they going to reintegrate into society or not? And those are the kinds of questions that I try to grapple with in this book when I followed Elaine Bartlett, you know, as she attempted to make that transition from prison back home.
Well, Jennifer Gonerman, thank you for actually bringing me back to the subject matter of the book, I Will Tend to Stray. Let me stray one more second, and then we'll hone in on the prison odyssey of Elaine Bartlett that you've written so well about. And that is that, of course, one observable function that the war on drugs has provided is the customers for the prison industrial complex. I mean, you couldn't have this massive prison industry if you didn't have people being sent to jail.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's look at Life on the Outside. Elaine Bartlett leaves prison. It's almost inconceivable sitting here to have that kind of 16-year hiatus. So what does she leave and what does she come back to when she leaves the New York prison system?
When she got locked up, she was 26 years old, had four children. The kids were all under 10 years old. And so when she came home... to her kids, they were all grown up. You know, they were all adults. Most of them were in their 20s. She had two sons and two daughters, and by the time she got home, one of her sons was also in the state prison system, which is often the case with parents who go to prison. The kids follow in the footsteps. So she came home to a family that was in complete disarray. She often used to say, I left one prison to come home to another.
Well, and I mean, I assume this is from a poor family. Where does she live in a neighborhood of New York City that Detroiters might know of, like Harlem or Bedford-Stuyvesant or something?
Well, when she first got out of prison, she moved to the Lower East Side, to a housing project on the Lower East Side. The housing project was very overcrowded, and in fact, she wasn't even supposed to be living there because in New York City, like a lot of cities, people coming out of prisons are not allowed legally to live in city housing and subsidized housing.
So it makes it even more difficult.
Right, right. That's pretty common across the country. I mean, there's a number of restrictions like that on people who have done time in prison. They're not allowed in public housing. There's often restrictions about obtaining welfare, about obtaining a driver's license. They can't vote. There's just numerous rules about what jobs they can get. So at the same time that America has more and more people coming out of prison, they're also making it much tougher with these various restrictions for these people to sort of reintegrate into society.
When you spoke with Elaine Bartlett, was she contrite or, I mean, these emotions I'm going to ask you about, I mean, they can be held simultaneously. You know, was she angry? Did she feel there was a racial component because she's an African-American? What was her feeling about what had happened to her over the last 16 years of incarceration?
Well, when I first met her back in 1998 and I went to the prison to interview her, I interviewed three different women that day, all of whom were first-time drug offenders. And the first two women each showed up individually, and they were all dressed up. You know, they'd brushed their hair, put their makeup on. They'd obviously dressed up to get their picture taken to be in the newspaper. And she was the third person who came. And she walked in the door, and instantly it was apparent that something was very wrong. She hadn't brushed her hair. She hadn't put any makeup on. She hadn't made any effort to look good. And I realized that, you know, she just looked terrible, and she was just deeply, deeply depressed. And I realized later that her friends in the prison had encouraged her to dress up, you know, to get her picture taken, but she didn't want to look any better than she felt. And she, at that time, had just lost her mother after being in prison for 14 years. So while she never denied that she was guilty in this case, she always questioned whether she really deserved 20 years in prison for a first-time offense, a first-time drug sale. You know, she freely admitted that she had committed a crime, but she just thought that the sentence did not fit the crime.
She, when she was 26, in the photograph you have of her in your book, Life on the Outside, she's a very attractive young woman, and she's an attractive middle-aged woman as well. So, I mean, has she, I mean, on one hand, you quoted her earlier about saying this is, you know, like prison on the outside, yet, I mean, what's her adjustment been like? I mean, she looks like she's brushed her hair on the cover photo of your book.
Well, she certainly did for the cover photo. But, you know, a lot of the scars that she brought out of prison are kind of invisible scars. Being away from her family for 16 years and her kids growing up without her has left very, very deep wounds. I mean, she came home to some very angry children. You know, like, I think a lot of parents confront when they leave prison. They come home and the kids are very, very mad because where have they been all those years? And while, and in her case, you know, she tried to play the mother role, and she continues to every day, which means sort of telling your kids what to do in part. And the kids are turning around and looking at her and saying, well, who are you to tell us what to do? Where have you been for 16 years? So there's a real sort of sense of role lost. You know, you've kind of lost your place in society, you've lost your place in the family. And those are things that are very hard to get back and things that take a lot of time.
Yeah, is she, I mean, what does one do when you come out of prison? I mean, I assume if she was a poor woman when she went in, or I mean, sometimes I guess you can learn some skills. Did she learn any what they call marketable skills for rehabilitation?
Well, she was lucky in that Bedford Hills Prison in New York State is pretty unusual. They do have a college program, and whereas most college programs and prisons have been eliminated across the country because Congress cut funding for them several years ago, there was a college program at her prison, and she was able to obtain a two-year degree, which I think helped her once she got on the outside. And she did manage to obtain an entry-level job as a counselor at a homeless shelter, dealing with a lot of men coming out of prison, actually. And she earned about $18,000 a year. It may sound like a lot of money in Manhattan. It's very hard to pay the rent on $18,000.
That doesn't sound like a lot of money in Detroit. I mean, it sounds like poverty wages.
Yeah, basically. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, she was much better off when she was 26. She was working at a hair salon, earning more as a 26-year-old than she was as a 42-year-old woman after she left prison.
I was trying to look through the material. George Bush, in his State of the Union address, talked about the Prisoner Reentry Initiative. Could you tell us a bit about that?
I don't know so much about the specifics of his program, but it is something that he did talk about in January in his State of the Union, which gave a lot of hope to people who have been working on this issue for many years. And he did set aside some money that's going to be used for programs. But a lot of people in the field, you know, criminologists and other experts, contend that preparing a prisoner for their release really needs to start almost from the day they get to prison, that it's not enough to just help them after they're released or just before they're released, but they really need to, you know, to prepare much earlier. You know, we have a lot of people coming out of prisons across the country who can't even read and write, and they may have been locked up for 5 or 10 or 15 years. Which seems, you know, sort of outrageous. And how can you possibly sort of survive in the world and make a living if you don't even have the most basic education? So I've always contended that I think people need, you know, preparation from the first moment they get locked up. But, of course, that would require sort of radical rethinking of our prison system, and I don't know if it's something that people are ready to do.
I was just going to ask that. Let me reintroduce you at this point. You're listening to The Peter Werby Show, and my guest is Jennifer Gonnerman. She's written Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett. Elaine Bartlett got 20 years to life for cocaine sales. She served 16, and we're using this as a way to talk about our large prison population and what happens to the mostly poor people that go in and then come out. And as you said, Jennifer, I always ask often when people have very, very good criticisms and critiques of a particular aspect of this society, and I almost always say, is there the political will to make any real change? And in a manner, you certainly answered that. But in fact, the people see prison in almost a 19th century manner. It's a penitentiary. It's where people go to do penance for the transgressions against society that they committed, and the information doesn't seem to get through that it ain't working.
I think that that you're very right in a lot of ways, but you know, one thing that is starting to get through, at least at the state level across the country, is that we've embarked on a very, very expensive crime control experiment, and you know, a lot of states are facing serious economic troubles, and it's forced a radical rethinking in a lot of cases about our drug laws and our prison system. You know, we're now spending $55 billion a year on our prison system.
Well.
Which is an extraordinary number, right?
It's lucky. Anyway, I was just going to say, it's lucky we don't need a national health program.
Well, now I think a lot of states You know, as I was saying a little bit earlier, about half the states in the country in the last few years have started to reform their drug laws in part to try to decrease the number of people who are locked up because they just can't afford to have such a large prison population.
I'm sure a lot of my Detroit listeners are aware, as I always probably unnecessarily note, that when I interview anyone in New York City, you always hear at one point during the interview, at least you hear sirens in the background.
Sorry about that. It's sort of inevitable. I'm in the middle of Manhattan.
I was going to say, you didn't probably even notice it, right?
Not really, but it occurred to me as I was talking to you that, about the sirens.
No, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. Back to Elaine Bartlett. Elaine Bartlett spends 16 years in jail. Did she see her children? Where was the prison located in relationship to New York City?
The prison she was in, Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, is in Westchester County, which is a little bit north of New York City and fortunately only about an hour away. Ironically, it is one of the wealthiest parts of the entire country. There's sort of a large number of very rich people have homes, even some people from Hollywood, have homes in Bedford and around Bedford Hills, New York. But she was able to see her kids with some regularity. They would come up and visit her once a week or once every few weeks over the years.
So, in other words, that she wasn't completely cut off. She did see her children growing. They did see her. And you said that there was this resentment that she'd been gone for so long. Did you get a chance to talk to the kids? I mean, did the kids think, Mom, you really screwed up badly and hence you've screwed us up? Or did they feel like their mom had been dealt a pretty bad hand?
It probably depended on how old the kids were. You know, as they got older, they understood a little bit more about how the system worked, and it was less blaming the mother and more understanding and in a larger context. But, you know, there's such a deep, deep well of pain for any kid who loses a parent to prison, especially for such a long period of time. And so that pain expresses it, you know, in depression. One of her kids was sort of suicidal. Another kid ended up, you know, going into the prison system himself. So there's just a great deal of pain, and often it comes out in anger and rage.
You know, there's, I was thinking about reentry. This is, Elaine Bartlett is obviously a woman, and men make up most of the incarcerated people. But, is there special problems that accrue to women, and are they repeat offenders less than men are? Do you know that?
The recidivism rates are very high, but women do tend to become repeat offenders at a slightly lesser rate. However, when they do come out of prison, they face a sort of double burden that's a little bit different from what men face, since women are usually the primary caretakers of the children, and most women in prison do have children. When they come home, they have the sort of double burden of both rebuilding their own lives, you know, finding a place to live, finding a way to make a living, and also trying to take care of their children. In some cases, it's not true in this book, but in some cases, women lose custody of their children while they're locked up. The kids go into the foster care system. And so once they get out, they have to battle for, you know, to try and get custody back from the children. At the same time, they're trying to get their own feet on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer Gonerman, in your book about Elaine Bartlett, Life on the Outside, suddenly someone who just got out of prison has attained sort of a 15 minutes of fame. How does she deal with this? Has it brought anything better to her life?
Well, the book has just come out about a week or two ago, and it's still starting to sink in. The first time she walked into a bookstore and saw her book in the front of a bookstore here in New York City, she almost fell over.
With her photograph on the cover.
Yeah, exactly, because her photograph's on the front, her name's in the subtitle. She walked into a bookstore here in Manhattan, and she could hardly believe it. I mean, of course she knew the book was in the works, but there's just something about, you know, seeing your face and your name right there in public that's sort of extraordinary. It would be extraordinary for anybody, but for somebody who is essentially forgotten by the larger society for 16 years, you know, all there was a mugshot of her in a dusty prison folder.
Hmm.
You know, and having a book come out where suddenly she's thrust into the public spotlight is almost the exact opposite of being of being sent to prison and sort of being made invisible.
Has she read it?
And silenced. She has read it. I don't know if she's read every page, but she's read most of it, and there's a lot of, you know, as I mentioned, there's a lot of pain in her story. So it became very difficult for her to read some parts of it because she would start to cry.
Well, that's interesting. I was thinking, like, if you, of course, you'd have a much shorter book if you wrote about my life. But I always wonder you'd say, wait a minute, because it's when you get described. I mean, of course, we all see ourselves in one way, and then we're mm-hmm. perceived by others. But in other words, she was happy and satisfied, let's say, with the portrait of you drew of her.
I think so. I mean, at this point, we've known each other for 6 years, which is quite a while. And I actually wrote a couple pieces for her about her in the Village Voice earlier. And as a result, she kind of knows how I write and what I've written about her. So there's a little bit more of a familiarity with the process than most people who might be the subjects of a book.
Now, just about 30 seconds. Do you still see her? Would you call her a friend or just sort of? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I would call her a friend. I mean, obviously, it's a very unusual friendship, but I talk to her and see her all the time. And, in fact, just talked to her earlier today, and we're just about to go on a book tour.
Huh. Well, from the back of the jacket of the book, Russell Simmons, who's the founder of Def Jam Records and the chairman of the Hip Hop Summit Action Network, says, at a time when the prison industrial complex is destroying African-American families and neighborhoods, Elaine Bartlett is more than a survivor. She is a heroine. The future of our communities depends on women like her. The book is Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett, and it's Strauss and Giroux. Jennifer Gonerman, the author, has been our guest. Thanks so much for having joined us.
Thanks so much. And if any of your listeners want a little more information, they can check out our website, which is www.lifeontheoutside.com.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for checking out WRIF.com. While you're here, don't forget to join the Riff Cyber Group. Get your ticket to a totally unfair internet advantage for the Riff on-air giveaways. Plus, you can win stuff that we don't even give away on the air. Awesome internet exclusives from WRIF.com and much more.
Oh, that sounds great.
Make sure you sign up with the Riff Cyber Crew today. Just click over to the Cyber Crew page while you're listening.
Any questions?
And thanks again for listening.
It's a dream.
It's a miracle.
It's great for women, too. WRIF.com. More Riff Rock is coming right up.
Living with depression can change your quality of life. Depression leaves you feeling sad, irritable, and tired. You lose interest and quit doing the things you used to enjoy, like going to the movies or out for dinner. You feel a loss of connection from your friends and family. You can't seem to motivate yourself to get out and do anything. You may have trouble sleeping. People who are depressed say it's like living life in black and white. If this sounds like you, you are not alone. Over 50 million Americans will suffer from depression sometime during their lifetime. Depression is not a personality problem or weakness. It is a real condition that affects the brain. Dr. Robert Bielski and the Institute for Health Studies are offering an investigational medication research study for depression. If you qualify, you'll receive study medication and all research-related care at no cost to you. For more information, call the Institute for Health Studies toll-free at 1-877-908-CARE. That's 1-877-908-CARE.
Imagine not being afraid to go to the dentist. Imagine being able to accomplish all of your dental care in as little as one appointment. This is what Sedation Dentistry at Dr. Katz in Livonia can do for you. You'll be able to smile with confidence and be proud of your appearance. If you've been putting off years of dental work, Sedation Dentistry will change your life. Over 35 million Americans have some level of anxiety when it comes to going to the dentist. But for many, it's more than being afraid. At Dr. Katz in Livonia, they understand that your fears may have kept you from the dentist. There's no need to feel embarrassed. At Dr. Katz in Livonia, they're not here to judge you. They're here to help you and encourage you so that you have the confidence a beautiful smile can bring. The experienced clinical team members at Dr. Katz in Livonia will make certain that you're relaxed and completely comfortable as they monitor you very closely while you're sedated. Many patients feel no discomfort whatsoever during and after the treatment. It may be as simple as taking a pill. Let Dr. Katz help you begin to enjoy your visits to the dentist with Sedation Dentistry. Wake up to a beautiful smile at Dr. Katz in Livonia. Call today for your free consultation. 734-464-2000. That's 734-464-2000.
Broadcasting worldwide on the web, you're listening to 101 WRIF at WRIF.com, a service of Greater Media. Keep it here for more Riff Rock coming right up.
All day Thursday, your walk right in free station, 101 The Riff, unleashes a ticket blitz Thursday. Keep your radio locked on 101 WRIF all day this Thursday
for your chance to hook
welcome with tickets to all of the hottest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Hooking you up like no other Detroit station can.
Listen for your chance to win.
Then call the RIP request line at 313-298-WRIF.
Don't forget. You can always improve your chances to win by joining the RIP Cyber Crew today and score your totally unfair internet advantage.
Just log on to WRIF.com.
It's Ticket Blitz Thursday on the RIP all day Thursday
from your Walk Right In free station. 101. The RIP.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like Bellasino's Pizza and Grinders with 18 locations, one near you. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's five best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save.
With the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talked to Bo Jackson. We had to ask him how much that bad hip has slowed him down.
I can guarantee you right now that I can come to your office and outrun both Paul and myself.
No. I can beat you in a 40 right now. What's your 40 time?
I couldn't beat you without a wet paper sack, man.
I don't know, Bo. I think you're still gimpy.
Gimpy, even when I was playing, but I was faster than 60-70% of the guys on the base.
The Hall, the big guys, the big well-heeled politicians, those huge corporations, you can't do it. They got too much power. They got too much money. They got all the lawyers. Well, I think you're going to be surprised with the guest that we have on our line today, because he's fought City Hall, he's fought the corporations, and he's won. The name of the book is Giant Killers, The Team and the Law That Helped Whistleblowers Recover America's Stolen Billions. And this is a book by Henry Schammel, Scammell, I guess it is, but he's not with it. With us. He is, in fact, I don't know what he's doing, but we have the subject of the book, the man that Henry Scammell writes about, John Phillips, and he's an attorney in Washington. His firm is called Phillips & Cohen. And John Phillips, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you for inviting me.
How are we doing with Henry's last name? Is that correct?
Scammell.
Yeah.
You got it.
All right. That's good. So you have fought a lot of different city halls. It's told in the book Giant Killers, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. And what I was the most surprised about was to see that part of the basis of this goes back to the Civil War. I wonder if you could tell us that story.
Well, the fight here in this book is really a fight against corrupt corporations that have been cheating the government. Often very powerful corporations, but it has its origins, this law, back in the Civil War era. In fact, the sponsor of the law was none other than Abraham Lincoln.
Hmm.
It's called, commonly called, the Lincoln Law. And he was so fed up with all these unscrupulous contractors doing business with the Union Army of selling the same horse two and three times and mixing sawdust with the gunpowder and making shoddy uniforms that fell apart in the rain, that he wanted to do something different to go after these people. And instead of, there really wasn't much of an enforcement mechanism for the government back then. So what he did was deputize citizens who knew about fraud being committed against the government, give them a legal basis to go into court and sue these wrongdoers, as George Bush would say. And if the recovery goes back to the Treasury, you get a percentage back in those days. You actually got up to 50% or whatever the Treasury got. Now, that law worked pretty well back then, but in the 1900s, the early 1900s, it largely fell into disuse because of restrictive court interpretations and some unanticipated consequences of amendments that Congress adopted.
Mm-hmm.
So It had been sitting there dormant, still on the books, and then not until 1986, when we had all these defense contractor scandals rising in the news, did this law get sort of revisited, revamped, modernized, and presented to Congress by both a conservative Midwestern senator, Senator Charles Grassley from Iowa, and a liberal Democrat congressman from California, Howard Berman. The two of them teamed up to revitalize this law and got Ronald Reagan to sign it into law in 1986, and it's just had an enormous impact on fraud against the Treasury, and really for the first time has protected the public fisc in ways that it hasn't been before.
Well, it's wonderful to have you, the book about you and your efforts, Giant Killers, but why haven't we heard about it, at least in the form that you have gone after these after this corruption?
Well, you probably have heard about it, but you might not realize that it's the stories that you read in the press really are about the use of this law. Oftentimes, if you see stories about big judgments and payments that are being made for fraud by defense contractors or health care providers to the Medicare program, oftentimes, I'd say in most times, the origin of that claim was a whistleblower lawsuit, a lawsuit filed under this law by an individual, usually an insider, who's aware of the fraud within the company, that uses this tool to go after, on behalf of the government, to go after the defrauding company. And now it takes a long time, but in the end, if they're successful in prosecuting the company with the assistance of the Department of Justice, that they are rewarded, and sometimes very handsomely rewarded. Oftentimes the news stories will just say, you know, Northrop Corporation today paid $60 million for cheating the government. Well, usually because somebody filed one of these lawsuits.
Tell us a little about whistleblowers. They're, you know, we always think of them, on one hand, as being very heroic, and yet oftentimes, I mean, we talked about the rewards that they could reap, but oftentimes it's not the rosiest road for them.
Well, it's actually a very, very hard road. In fact, I often call it, for each of my clients, you know, a life-changing experience, because once you travel down, take that first step down that road, there's no turning back, and the consequences for you and your family can often be, you know, very catastrophic and very serious. You can, you know, most commonly lose your job because companies don't like to keep on board people who are rocking the boat. You can find yourself unemployable in your own profession or your own field, because the companies in the same field will often blackball people and that who would be considered whistleblowers. And you find you can't put food on your table. You're no longer employed for your family. People lose their houses. Sometimes they often have high incidence of divorce and sometimes even suicides. This is the good news for whistleblowers, this law, because it's a real empowerment tool, and it enables you know, even the smallest person to go after the largest corporation and offers a measure of protection in their employment status, lets them use the full force of the government to join in the efforts, and at the end of the process, they can be vindicated, the company could be brought to justice, and they could be very, very handsomely rewarded. So this is the good news for whistleblowers, this law and the use of this law.
Now, tell me how a whistleblower who sees corruption in a big corporation that's doing business with the government, that's ripping off the government, hence us, the taxpayers, how does John Phillips in the law firm of Phillips and Cohn get into the act? I mean, what role, who engages you, and what role do you play?
Well, the way this law works is you, the whistleblower, if you see this, you don't just go to the government and tell them about it. Actually, that wouldn't do quite as much as if you were actually able to prepare and file a lawsuit. So what happens are people who believe that this law has been violated, that the government's been defrauded, will come to us, our law firm, because we have an expertise in the area, and we will investigate thoroughly all the facts and then make a determination as to whether we think the case is sufficient and there really is evidence of fraud here, and then we will file the case in the name of the person, the client, and in the name of the government. It's filed under seal. We work with the Justice Department and the other government agencies involved to further investigate it, and then the government decides whether to join the case or not. And if they do, we then are basically private attorneys general working with the Department of Justice, pushing the case forward.
Hmm.
One of the main objectives that Congress had here was to increase the amount of resources available to the government to pursue the government claims. One of the big problems, people think of the government as all-powerful and very, very substantial, but oftentimes in these cases, the government has been completely outmanned by these defense contractors and these defendants in these cases who bring in just legions of lawyers. This is the equalizer because we bring in all the supporting cast that the government needs to pursue the claim.
Well, I was going to say, if you're taking on some of these big defense contractors that have been fined over, say, the last 10, 15 years or so, they have some pretty powerful attorneys, and since literally millions, sometimes tens of millions are at stake,
Hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions, thank you. Yeah, tens of millions. What's that these days? That you're up against some powerful legal big
shots.
And I mean Phillips and Cohen, your law firm sounds like a couple of guys. Is it larger than it sounds?
Well, actually, my partner's a woman. we have 12 lawyers in Washington and San Francisco. But let me give you an example. That's a good question. We had a big case recently it was actually a healthcare case against HCA, Health Corporation of America, the largest for-profit hospital chain in the country, 350 hospitals. A massive fraud alleged against the Medicare program systematically by this company, centrally planned, at all these hospitals, how they every year overcharge the government in various complex ways. Well, what will usually happen in a case like that, since it's so big, it involves millions of documents. To do a case like that, you need a lot of resources. Well, the company's position almost was, look, we're bigger than the government. We can outlast them. We've got three law firms here, and we're going to outlast you and exhaust you. And, I mean, they don't say it that way, but that's always the message that they send. Well, in this case, once the case really turned the corner into active litigation, the government came to us and said, look, we need resources. We can only provide three lawyers who are full-time equivalents. We need a total of 20. Would you provide 17 or so lawyers to us? And we said, absolutely. This is an important case, a lot of money at stake. We went out and got five other law firms to join forces with us. At one point, we had 70 lawyers on our side working on the case against the other law firms. The government put all the resources they had available, which were about five lawyers, but we brought them to justice. They wound up, this company paid back to the Treasury for all the various frauds they engaged in, $1.7 billion. They would have paid nothing back without this lawsuit having been initiated by a whistleblower and without these teams of lawyers that we were able to marshal on our side to work with the Department of Justice to say, we're there for as long as it takes. We are not going away. You are not going to overrun the government. The government's going to get its money back, and by God, we did.
Now, you mentioned whistleblowers getting a percentage. Is it public information as to what the whistleblower complainant received? What percentage of that $1.7 billion? I mean, even at a small percentage, that's a fortune for an individual.
Well, it is, but the $1.7 billion involved a multiple of cases and claims against the companies that was all unleashed initially by this case. Well, I can tell you, it's public record. The aspect of the case that related specifically to the claims that were brought for our clients were, roughly, I think the way you'd add it up and allocate it, close to $700 million.
Wow.
And the relators share the amount. You know, you're under the statutory scheme, you're entitled to between 15 and 25% of whatever the Treasury gets back. And in this case, there was $100 million that was made available to the clients. But you must understand, the case took 10 years.
No.
That wasn't just the clients and all these lawyers, these 70 lawyers I mentioned, and five law firms, we put out something in the range, I think, of $6 million in out-of-pocket expenses on our side that we had to borrow and come up with to pursue the government claims. And then there were other consultants along the way, and the clients had to give up percentages for just to live and to eat to other people who helped them along the way. But it still was a lot of money at the end. Oh, no, it did fine.
John Phillips is my guest on the Peter Werby Show, and if you're enjoying the story as I am, I want to tell you about the book, but it is not. It is about John Phillips, our guest. It is not by him. The book is called Giant Killers, the team and the law that help whistleblowers recover America's stolen billions, and the team is headed by John Phillips. The book is by Henry Scammell. It's S-C-A-M-M-E-L-L, and it's published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Now, I'm working for International General, and I see that, and they're doing business with the government. I see there's all this fraud going on. What typically is going to motivate me? Is it ethics, or is it the possibility of recovering the kind of money we're talking about in this HCA return?
Well, you know, every case is different, and the motivation of every person is different. Sometimes it will be just a real conscience sense. Of conscience and ethics and what's doing what's right. Sometimes it will be a person who fears that if they don't do something, they're going to be caught up in what can be considered criminal activity. They may be coerced into doing it by their employer, and they don't want to, you know, find out 3 or 4 years later that someone's pointing a finger at them when they really didn't were a most reluctant participant. You know, a cold calculation that if I do this, then I know the facts are solid, that I'm going to make a lot of money. It is that sometimes as well. Congress really said, we want the information out there. We know they're only scratching the surface in getting this information about the ways in which the government's been defrauded, and we're going to create incentives for people to come forward with solid information and incentives to bring private resources to bear to pursue those claims. And if it's a person who's just motivated by the money, well, hey, the government's better off because it's got the information and it's going to get the money back. If it's somebody motivated by a real pangs of conscience, then that's good too. And, you know, the ultimate result being the government's going to get the money back. So it's a lot of motives.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning of our interview about the False Claims Act, a Lincoln law that allowed people to go after these companies that were doing, were selling the government shoddy goods. And actually, your publicist, who I love and who always gets me the greatest guests like you, I usually kind of pride myself in thinking of my own questions, but she had a good one here. She's, what's the derivation of the word shoddy as it applied to the bum goods that were being sold to the Union Army?
Well, shoddy was actually, in the back at the time of the Civil War, was a form of cloth that was made. It was really a lot of pieces of cloth that were taken and put into a sort of a soluble solution, and then that was rolled and ironed out into make sort of sheets of cloth that looked very much like cotton or cloth, which was used by some unscrupulous contractors to make uniforms. Now, there's only one problem with this material called shoddy, that's what it was named. When it was under stress, or especially when it got wet, it came apart.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the term shoddy had become used generically to apply to defective products or something with poor workmanship or badly made. But it really had its derivation in this material used to make Union uniforms.
Now, Abraham Lincoln was so concerned, as you told us earlier, of the poor quality of goods being sold and how badly the government was being ripped off in this war effort. The law comes into being, it's used for a while, then you said it goes into pretty much disuse up until 1986. Is it possible to know, I mean, sort of a corruption index? I mean, were things worse in 1863 than they were in 1986 or in 2004? How do we get an idea of how much of our tax dollars is actually going where it's supposed to and not lining the pockets of corrupt entrepreneurs?
Well, it's a huge amount has gone over the years to fraud. You know, as you mentioned, it's not really a new problem. Something about the government, there's this easy mark for these unscrupulous business agents and companies that that work with the government, they feel it's sort of fair game to go cheat the government in some way. In fact, there's a quote that Henry Scanlon has at the beginning of the book that says, it goes as follows, "There's no kind of dishonesty into which otherwise good people more easily and frequently fall than that of defrauding the government." Well, guess who said that? That was Benjamin Franklin back in the foundings of the country. It was a lot of fraud going on. I think it continued pretty rampant fraud all in those early years. You read some of the old history, it's really quite amazing, but it continued on in maybe more sophisticated forms over the years. And I would say it really reached its peak, especially in the defense procurement side, in the 80s, and the big Reagan defense buildup when they put in so much more money into the defense program that these contractors were just getting billions of dollars more than they did the previous years. They couldn't figure out how to spend it fast enough. So the temptation was very great to just take that money and sort of lie about what they did with it. And that's when you heard those stories about the $600 toilet seats and $1,000 wrenches that you could buy for $298 down at your hardware store. That really got the attention here of Senator Grassley, who held hearings and would just be outraged at how easily the government was being ripped off. And there was no real attempt to get the money back to the Treasury. So with this law, he wanted to try to do something different. Enlist the citizenry to go out and do the government's work and give them a real incentive, dollars in their pocket if they're successful. And I would have to say today, it has had a tremendous deterrent effect that the estimated savings in some studies that have been in the hundreds of billions of dollars that this law, by merely being there, has discouraged others from assuming they're going to get away with it. It's brought in $12 billion directly to the Treasury, but the estimate is that many, many times more than that it saved the government, because it's just too risky today to continue business as usual and steal from the government, because the likelihood is you're going to get caught, you're going to get treble damages applied against you, and it may even launch a criminal investigation, so you might get indicted. When you have those kind of elements lining up, companies and people within those companies are saying, not anymore. We can't afford to do it.
Well, Don Phillips, being involved in the law, I'm sure that you know that one of the ways, at least the appearance of that could happen, would be with lax enforcement. Now, why I say that is that we've just witnessed the beginnings of a criminal investigation into the Halliburton's procurement of gasoline supplies to Iraq and all of that. I guess when I heard that, I was sort of stunned. I was thinking, why would these guys that are already making billions, why would they risk, as you were just saying? So, could it be anything that there is less enforcement or lax enforcement rather than actual decline?
You got the Halliburton circumstance. Certainly that's a case where this law under normal circumstances would apply, but once you have the public investigations and disclosure of that, then you presume the government's going to go after it. And I think they are, quite frankly. I don't think Halliburton's going to get away with it. Although Halliburton has had a pretty checkered history, and they have been nailed by this law before and had to pay money back. When you have that kind of money under those unstructured conditions over there in Iraq, and is not really rigid or strict accounting procedures and keeping track of it, the temptation, again, is very great to be very sloppy and always err on the side of benefiting the company financially, especially when you have a sort of a crisis environment and the government's willing to turn over lots of this money to keep everything going. Make sure those troops get fed and they get the gasoline, pay whatever it takes. Then you look back and say, well, shouldn't have taken that much. And they'll get them for that. These companies sometimes just can't help themselves. And, the pressures are imposed on these managers. Go over, make as much as you can. They do go over the line, then way over the line. But good news is they're getting caught much more often today.
Well, I know you were instrumental in founding the Center for Law and the Public Interest, so I guess you would have no qualms about litigating yourself out of business, at least this aspect of law, that corporations stopped ripping off the public. Have you noticed any decrease in the number of cases that are coming into your firm on this basis?
Well, yes. I mean, you're right. I mean, to the extent the law really works, we'll be out of business. And that's fine with me, because there's lots of other work to do. Yes, I have. I mean, I know this just dealing with the defense counsel on the other side, talking, you know, seeing these companies from the inside. When you sue them and litigate with them, you get a good sense of, you know, how they operate. And there is a lot more care, as I mentioned before, and mainly because the risks of getting caught are so much greater today, and getting exposed and getting indicted. And but there's still a lot of fraud. There's, you know, when the government spends huge sums of money, you're always going to have a number of companies that are simply going to do everything they can to steal the government blind. And that's where this law will continue to have a very important role.
Anything on the horizon that we should look for that you can say you heard it here from John Phillips? I don't know if you want to give anything away.
Well,
or
a lot of these things, when they're filed, they're under seal, so I'm not really permitted to talk about specific cases. I would say, you know, the first cases here started in the defense industry, the defense procurement industry, and it's moved more rapidly in the last several years into health care fraud, the Medicare program. People wonder why Medicare costs are going so high. Well, a lot of it, believe it or not, is due to fraud against the program. But there are new areas, and I think an important new area we're going to see huge amounts paid back is in the pharmaceutical industry. And all the games the pharmaceutical companies have paid that have had the effect of overcharging various government programs, Medicaid programs especially, and Medicare. You're going to see, I think, billions of dollars coming back to the Treasury because of their practices.
Now, I always tell people, John Phillips, if you hear a siren in the back while I'm interviewing somebody, it means they're in New York City, but not the case here. You're in Washington, D.C.
No, I'm in Washington, and I got to tell you, right around this time of day, that's usually Vice President Cheney going back right through DuPont Circle back to his house up on Massachusetts Avenue.
Okay. Thank you so much. My guest has been John Phillips. Now, one thing to be careful of here. The book published by Atlantic Monthly Press is called Giant Killers, the team and the law that help whistleblowers recover America's stolen billions. My guest, John Phillips, is who this book is about. The author is Henry Scammell, S-C-A-M-M-E-L-L. And you can, again, I said Atlantic Monthly Press. John Phillips, thank you so much for being with me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for inviting me.
Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werby and produced by OD. Stay tuned for more Riff Rock coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Men, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
David Hall here with Trudy Daniels, the honorary mortgage expert. Trudy, don't know if you heard, Greenspan just reported fixed-rate mortgages are potentially way too expensive. Folks need to look at adjustables. Did you hear?
I know. He says that. And a recent Census Bureau study seems to agree. Most Americans live in their homes on average 5 to 7 years, so why pay thousands of additional dollars in interest for long-term money they'd never use?
Great point.
I don't think I would have come up with it had you not prompted me, but...
A Rock Financial Mortgage expert can really make the difference with a little expert advice, as you well know.
So they can show me the difference between an adjustable and a fixed rate on paper, and I'll know?
You bet. Folks will be amazed at the money you can save in interest over the life of their loan by matching your mortgage to your lifestyle.
Oh, are we talking big, big dollars here?
Big.
Really big.
Big.
Call Rock Financial, 800-333-ROCK. Or go to rockfinancial.com. They are Michigan's largest mortgage company, ready to help you 24 hours a day.
24 hours a day.
That's right, 800-333-ROCK. Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company, equal housing lender.
Ah, St. Patrick's Day. Hi, there's nothing more magical and special. It goes from missing a day of work, having a wonderful conversation with dear friends over a nice pint of green beer. Let me fill you in on a little secret. Not a better place exists to celebrate St. Patrick's Day that is more Irish, more magical, and more lucky than Wild O'Woodies. To the young lasses, lads, at Wee Bairns, get to Wild O'Woodies this Wednesday night for a St. Patrick's Day celebration not to be missed. Join the rich little lass, Annie Cardini, for 25 cents green beer. She'll be bringing a pot of gold filled with metal shamrocks, tickets to Ozfest at DGE, plus other riff prizes. Get a bit of the devil in you and have a go at the pie-eating contest, musical chairs, and more spirit-filled games. Enjoy an evening filled with those flowery laythings, green beads, and Irish tunes. Not to mention the lucky charms the bonny lasses have to offer. On St. Patty's Day, Wild O'Woodies opens the doors at 11 a.m. Enjoy the wee morning hours with beef cabbage, green beer, and plaid skirts. This Wednesday night, you want to be at the greenest spot on the east side. Wild O'Woodies, a St. Patrick's Day celebration not to be missed. Hosted by WRIF's Annie Carlini. Wild O'Woodies on Grash. One box on the 14 Mile in Rockin' Roseville. For more information, call the Wild Line at 586-294-5331.
Hey, this is Meltdown from the Rift, plugging Joe Pannion Chevrolet. And I gotta be honest, I don't just endorse anybody that wants to come on the station. All right? I'm proud to be associated with the guys from Joe Pannion Chevrolet, the unbeatable dealership, giving you an unbeatable price on a Chevy. Check this out, a 2004 Silverado lease, $213 a month. No down payment, just sign, crank that bad boy over, and drive a true piece of Americana right off the parking lot. You can customize your truck as well. Wood grain dash packages, custom wheels, DVDs, subs. Of course, you got to have the rumbling exhaust system. You want people to know you're coming in your Chevrolet. And hey, if you work out of your truck, Pannion can upfit one with racks, plows, spreaders, anything you need for your job. Joe Pannion has it. Smoking deals, man, this month. Silverado for $213 a month or less. Call 866-JOE-1111. Bring any quote in on a Chevy and tell them Meltdown says to beat it. They're online too, theunbeatabledealer.com. Check out Joe Pannion's trucks. You won't want to go anywhere else. Chevrolet, an American Revolution.
If you've seen them, you'd understand. If you have